Something to wrestle with. Bruce Pritchard. Hey, it's Conrad Thompson, and you're listening to Something to Wrestle With. Bruce Pritchard. Bruce, what's going on, man? How are you?
I am absolutely excellent, and I have to correct you. We are now the award-winning best sports podcast of the year. Something to Wrestle With, Bruce Pritchard.
How about that, man? That's a pretty big deal, you know, from this just being kind of an idea this time about a year ago to now. You went to the Academy of Podcasting, and they had the Academy of Podcasting Awards yesterday, and we had some stiff competition with shows from ESPN, shows from CBS, shows from Podcast One, you know, well-established shows, and here we are, a couple of guys in a pool house and a garage making it work.
Kind of scary, isn't it?
Well, it just goes to show you, man, that anything can happen here in the World Wrestling Federation, right?
Well, that's what they say, but anything can happen right here on Something to Wrestle With, Bruce Pritchard, by God. It was crazy, man, and just to be up there, it took a minute before I realized, and I had to look up at the big screen, and it had the logo up there, and I was just kind of had to pinch myself a little bit to realize that was really us. They like us, man. They like us.
And we really like you guys, man. I'm still kind of in shock that we've got these awards coming back to Alabama and Texas here, and that this is a real thing. So we need to thank everybody who's helped make this possible. Of course, Court Bauer and MLW took a chance on Brother Love and the Mortgage Guy more than a year ago. And since then, we've made a lot of new friends along the way. Dave Silva has been doing our graphics, you know, since, I don't know, almost the very beginning. Matt Coon has come on board and has started to make our show sound a little more fun with some music here and there. And just all the people who've helped along the way, whether it's, you know, Chris or Wilson or any of those guys who have helped out in a big way. Mike, we have had tons of support with the show, and we had a lot of support last weekend in New York City, man. We had two back-to-back shows. I had a blast. I've got really good feedback. We need to give a special shout-out to James Mattern and Shuley from the Sturm Show. Man, Shuley was awesome. Such a cool guy. I feel like I knew him already just from being a Stern listener. And James Mattern, a super funny guy. But what a show we had on Sunday, man. We promised a big surprise, and did we deliver or what? We had Dan Soder there. If you haven't heard, and Bruce has even admitted this now, has the very best Macho Man Randy Savage impression of all time. He also does one hellified Andre the Giant. But the big surprise to me was the shadowy figure, Oz himself, Brian Gerwerts, or however you say I'm supposed to say his name like a redneck. He attended our show. You know, Brian never does this. I've never even seen a picture of Brian. And not only did we see a picture, he was there telling stories, and he stole the show, Bruce.
Yeah, you know, when I was sitting on the couch with Brian in the back and looked at him and said, hey, do you want to come out and be a part of the show? The hesitation in his voice when he answered, no, I don't think so. That gave me that small opportunity that you need. When there's just a little bit of hesitation to go ahead and jump on it and say, okay, hey, great, man, we'll just bring you out for a couple of minutes. And we brought him out for a couple minutes, and he ended up staying for the whole show. And yes, the little son of a bitch stole the show. And thank you to Brian just for coming out in general, because it was great to see him. Been several years. And frigging Dan Soder coming out with the Macho Man. And I had totally planned on having a macho off with him, but when I closed my eyes, Macho Man was in the room, and I knew I had nothing. I just had nothing.
It was awesome. But what we had was a great time. Thanks to everybody who made it possible. The folks at Gramercy were so awesome. We hope that we're able to come by and come see you guys again next year. It was a blast, and it wouldn't have been possible without your support. Thank you so much for supporting the show the way you did. It's pretty cool to meet you guys before the show and just chat about what your favorite episode has been, or what your favorite bit has been, or what you'd like to hear more about. But there are some stories that we just can't share here on the podcast. And Brian gave us some great ones about a little free bird bed and a little free bird house, and Gunther. And there's just so the Rock with the Triple H.
All the stupid babies. You just stupid baby.
All right, Bruce, you can't go any further. We actually didn't tell that story on stage. That was a backstage story. All right, Bruce, it's time for What Happened When? The WWE presented SummerSlam 2002. It went down 15 years ago today, August 25th, 2002, from the Nassau Coliseum in Uniondale, New York. Of course, the year prior, there's no competition. WWE, or F at the time, I guess, had swallowed up both WCW and ECW. We're down to just one company, and we're in a little bit of a transition. Lots of things are happening. We're going to cover it in long form today. But, Bruce, you watched this pay-per-view for the first time in a long time this week. What'd you think?
Top to bottom, like I've said here before, sometimes I tend to fast forward through the matches. I watched intently and thoroughly enjoyed top to bottom this pay-per-view. I thought that the matches were great, and it was a lesson in psychology. So for all you guys out there that want to be wrestlers and want to know how to tell a better story in the ring, I suggest you go back and you watch SummerSlam 2002 and learn.
No, I totally agree. I'm a big fan of this pay-per-view. I'd kind of forgotten how loaded the card was until I started to get going on this one. But it did huge business everywhere you look. They did 14,797 paid for a gate of $893,625. This was a sellout. Bruce, any guess on how long it took to sell out?
3 minutes.
Well, 90 minutes.
Seconds.
90 minutes, but pretty close. I like that you went 317 because it's just one after Austin 316, right?
Well, of course.
A gate like this and an automatic sellout like that, is this something that everybody's all high fives about? Or are you kind of wondering, shit, man, if it sold out in 90 minutes, could we have got a bigger venue somewhere?
Most of us were wondering why the hell it took so long to sell out.
I love that you were.
It's like, damn, what are we doing wrong? It took almost 90 minutes. We were really sweating it there the last 22 minutes because thinking, shit, maybe it's not going to go all the way.
I love you for that. All right. Speaking of revenues, you know, I've got to break it down when I can. Dave Meltzer wrote about it in the July 8th, 02 Observer, saying that revenue was down only about 7% from the prior year. 456 was the record breaking year that the WWE had in 2001. Here they were on pace for 425. Meltzer would write, "It should be noted that while business began to sink almost literally the day after WrestleMania X7, the really serious collapse just started this past May and will not be reflected until the next quarterly report. Next year's fiscal 2003 report could potentially be one for the ages." You know, I know you were just bragging a minute ago, Bruce, about how quickly this sold out. But at this point, were you guys already starting to feel that business had dipped a little bit? Was somebody hitting the panic button, or was it just cruise control because there's no competition and you're still profitable?
No, there was no panic and business was still good. It was simply a different time, and we were happy with what we were doing. We were doing less shows, and so we knew that the revenue was going to be down over doing more shows the previous year. So there was no need to hit the panic button because television was still selling out, and house show business for the most part was good.
Okay, Bruce, some of this is going to start to sound familiar. Live event revenue is down 10%. It was 81.9 the prior year. Now it's 74.1. But here's the real kicker. They're running more events this year. They're running 237 events compared to only 212 the prior year, which means that your average show, this is an average show now, guys, in 2001 drew a gate of $386,320, and now it's down to just $312,658. Attendance, therefore, is down 17%. Your pay-per-view revenues were also down from 128 down to just 112 million. And that's because the buys went from 8 million down to just 7.1. However, television rights fees were up. And that is a significant improvement. So chat me up about the way the business started to change, because this feels like the first time we see all the other, you know, indicators start to show that business is on a downward trend. But television rights is kind of making up the difference. Is this the first time you remember that shift in business being that way?
Well, it's, again, when you go public, they're looking at the bottom line, and they're looking at what the company makes at the end of the year. And obviously, I think there's a lot of ways that that can be skewed and that they can write some things off. We're going to go ahead and we're going to take a loss for this quarter because we're going to increase our revenues next quarter. And obviously, I'm not the financial genius and don't understand all of that completely, but all Vince cared about was the bottom line. And if we were making more money in rights fees, then that compensated for making less money in overall live events. The model that had been in the past of live events driving your business is we see now that that model was slowly changing right before our very eyes.
Meltzer would break down with much more detail here if you'd like to see this. This is in the July 8th, 2002 issue of The Observer, but he's specifically breaking down, you know, how everything is moving up and down and all around. But one of the things I was fascinated with is how home video revenues were up 12%, which is one of their biggest growths. And I wondered, well, why is that? And then Meltzer made it plain here because DVDs got hot. So the idea being lots of wrestling fans, and how about this? Lots of Disney fans and movie fans. They had already established their VHS collection, but now the world is catching on to DVD. They like this new medium. So they're going to go buy the same shows again just to have them in the new medium. That has to be something that Vince and company has their finger on, and they start releasing some of that old stuff on DVD again, right?
Well, not only that, but it's you're looking at a whole brand new delivery system that was cheaper and you could deliver it a whole hell of a lot more. A CD is much smaller than a VHS. And like you said, there was this whole phenomenon that people who had already purchased all those WrestleManias before on VHS, now we could do a box set in DVD form. It just was a whole new deal when it went. I remember going from 8-track to cassette to CD. That's what we were experiencing right now. So the revenue, you're just repeating what you'd already sold on a whole new format.
Merchandise was down 9% to 26.2 million, and they pegged a lot of that on the attendance drop, which makes sense, right, Bruce? The bulk of your merchandise was sold at house shows back then. Obviously, the WWE Shop Zone is a big portion now, but back then, folks came to the arenas with cash in their billfolds to get these shirts, right?
And that's where you sold your gimmicks, the old school, man. Come to the live event, get your pictures, get your T-shirts, get your posters. And that's where a great bulk of the merchandise money was made.
Licensing took the biggest hit. You see revenues go from 120 million down to just 101 million. Do you remember there being a time where putting WWF on the logo on anything, that old scratch logo, just meant it was going to fly off the shelves and you were getting ridiculous offers for licensing to products? Do you remember one in particular where you heard, hey, we were just pitched a WWF version of this, and you thought, God, I hope they don't make that.
There were a lot of those, and a lot of them we made, from Beanie Babies to just ridiculous stuff that the marketing people would come in. And like you said, they would just pitch these horrendous ideas of, well, right now I can see them going in and somebody doing the pop sockets that are really hot now with the WWE logo. But if you could put a logo on it, we were being pitched it. And it was any and everything under the sun. I believe that was during a time that Jim Bell was in as well, or maybe he had left by then. But popcorn, every kind of drink cup you can ever imagine. If like I said, you could put a logo on it, we were pitched.
One of the things that I've always been fascinated with is the nightclub, the World Nightclub, and they actually do a cutaway here on the show, so we'll talk about it a little more there as well. But this used to be called WWF New York, and you guys tried this a few different ways, but it seemed to be a fairly consistent money loser. And here Meltzer's reporting it's down 15%, and he says that they had kind of sort of blamed it on September 11th. How much of an impact do you think September 11th had on the WWF's, you know, restaurant and bar and nightclub effort, given that tourism and travel and some of that was certainly going to take a hit?
I think you can attribute some of it to that. But the rent in Times Square was astronomical. The food was not good. I mean, when you want to go out to eat, you don't go to the Hard Rock Cafe or Planet Hollywood. You sure didn't go to the World, to the WWF New York. It great location, expensive, but people looked at it. The general tourist, if you weren't a wrestling fan, there was no reason to go in there. And it just kind of fizzled. And it fizzled, and they tried to rebrand it as the World and just do it a nightclub. And the rebranding of the World was try to get people in on the Thursday, Friday, Saturday night club scene.
Right.
In New York. That was the first, it was, matter of fact, it was the first place that Chris Angel ever played and got a lot of national attention. And I remember we used to have to go and see the acts and go down and watch these guys, see if they had anything. And can we do it? Can we do something with them on TV to promote them? And Chris had this gimmick where he was going to submerge himself in water for 24, 48 hours, whatever the hell it was. And we did it live on Raw. And it was a disaster. Would be the nicest thing I could say about it, because he was pissing in the water and the water got murky, and it's like, he's got a tank, he's got a tube. What's, how hard is it? It didn't look difficult. You know what I mean? I'm sure it is to be submerged in water that long. I'm sure it's a great stunt, all that, but it didn't look impressive. And just kind of sucked. I don't know how much that helped Chris, because Chris was great. Chris was great live, and he was a hell of an attraction at the World. But Chris was probably the best act that we had kind of coming through there at the time.
When Vince McMahon sees that this Chris Angel thing is getting sideways and the water's murky and blah, 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 what's his reaction?
God damn, what's in the water? Did he poop himself? Ugh, can you imagine the feces floating around and getting up his nose and under his nails? Ugh, disgusting.
It's amazing.
Don't let him shake my hand.
It's important to recognize, too, here that overall profit is down, but let's carry what they had going on at the time. You've got 164.8 million, which is down from 197 million. That's profit, boys and girls. But expenses increased from 104.1 to 109.6. Now, what costs more? The name change. You got that going. The World Nightclub and increased promotional costs. So there's a lot going on here. But the prior year, even when they had $197 million profit, that included the way they picked up WCW and this is a big deal, the Owen Hart settlement. So you've got lots of stuff going on here. And even though business is down, they made $164.8 million. That's some major cash. They gave this forecast for 2003. Revenues are expected to grow 7% for the next year. I find that interesting, given that all the indicators were that business was down. They thought they could still somehow get a 7% increase. And how did they do that? Well, they said they plan to run 339 events. And that is way, way, way more than what they were running in 01 and 02. This is still a fraction of what you guys ran in the 80s. When it comes out that you guys are going to be ramping up the house show business this much, in the idea that maybe fewer people are coming out to see you per show, so the methodology is, let's just have more shows. Is there any pushback from the younger generation who weren't there to see the crazy schedule you guys had in the late 80s?
No, because they wanted the money. They wanted to be able to get out and work, and they wanted to have the opportunity to work more. So that was great for them, because the more opportunity, the more live events, the more events of any kind, that was a plus for them. They loved it. Guys wanted to work. That was a time, a beautiful time in the business, when talent actually wanted to work.
It's a big deal. And if you'd like to see more of this sort of breakdown of the finances. It's the July 8th, 2002 issue of the Observer. I love it. This is also the same Observer, though, where it comes out that Bret Hart had had a stroke. And I'm sure we're going to talk about this in great detail about Bret Hart and his return later and all that stuff. But do you have any memories of Bret having this stroke and what the conversation was inside the office at the time?
Well, we were all concerned for him. This was still during a time that Bret and Vince had not kind of reconciled. They haven't hugged it out at this point. But any time that you hear one of your comrades is down, you feel bad for him. And no one really knew the extent of Bret's stroke, especially when it first came out. You heard he was in a bike accident. Well, first thing that goes through your mind is that he was on a motorcycle.
Right.
He was actually on a mountain bike and was wearing a helmet. But it's scary, someone that age having a stroke. And the concern, we were just concerned for Bret. And no matter what your differences are at the time, you still hate to hear that, bad shit about anybody.
So let me ask, did Vince call Bret and check on him? Does anybody call and check on him, or does that not happen?
I believe that Vince called the Hart family. I don't think that Vince spoke to Bret directly, but I know that he did call the family and make sure, see how Bret was doing and send him flowers. And it wasn't too long after this that the reconciliation with Vince and Bret took place. As a matter of fact, took place in Boca.
Okay, we'll talk about that another time. I just wanted to at least mention that this is around the same time that the accident happened.
Right.
I do want to talk about Les Thatcher here, because Les Thatcher is running the HWA, the Heartland Wrestling Association. It's down in Cincinnati. And around this time, as a cost-cutting measure, according to the rumor and innuendo, Shane makes the call and has it approved by Vince to cut all ties with the developmental territory HWA that Les was running. This kind of leaves Jim Cornette and Danny Davis and their Ohio Valley Wrestling in Louisville as the sole development group at the time. Why did this happen, and what kind of went sideways with Les?
Nothing went sideways with Les, and it was not Shane McMahon's call either. It was Jim Ross's call. It was a cost-cutting measure where we had several developmental systems working at the time and cutting back. And Les, unfortunately, did not have nearly as big of an operation as OVW had at the time. And OVW was able to run several live events. They were doing live television and cost cutting. Something had to go, budget. But that was Jim Ross's call. Shane would have had nothing to do with that.
Afford Anything talks about how to avoid common pitfalls, how to refine your mental models, and how to think about how to think.
Paula, while certainly you can mess up on $1 million a year, it is far less likely than it is on $30,000 a year.
Right.
I would meet wonderful people that were struggling with a budget that was super tight. It was 100%. You need to make more money.
Make smarter choices and build a better life.
Afford Anything, wherever you listen.
Around the same time that they're trying to cut costs here, they open the WWE Films Department. This is right out of the Figure Four. A new Los Angeles-based division headed by Joel Simon, the producer of Wild Wild West and X-Men, among other films, will handle the movie careers of all the WWE superstars. Catch me up, Bruce. Why is this a good decision? If we're worried about showing less profit, so we're trying to cut a developmental territory, why would we open a films division?
The opportunity to make more money. And there was an opportunity in Hollywood to be able to utilize the WWF superstars, WWE superstars. And by having studios and having representation in Hollywood to be able to get our talent in movies, but also to be able to produce our own movies. And while people may laugh at it and go, oh yeah, well, the Marine and all these other movies went straight to video. There's a lot of money in straight-to-video movies and in low-budget movies, and it gets exposure, and there is a market out there to do that, and that's what we were looking at. We weren't looking – well, that depends on who you ask. Vince was probably – Vince would tell you that he was looking to be the next Disney and the next Universal. The reality of the situation was that we wanted to get a foothold in Hollywood and have a presence presence in Hollywood to be able to get our guys in roles and get them in movies. And that's how you do it. It was to grow. It's not like, okay, well, you know, that was a growing deal and it wasn't going to make money right away.
It was said at the time that, and Simon said this, Booker T, Big Show, and Triple H were the superstars who he thought had the potential to be in the WWE films. Do you know of any ideas for characters or movies or angles or storylines that were discussed with those guys that ultimately were shot down?
Yeah, one was, well, first of all, Vince and I had an idea of doing this story with Booker T as a drug dealer that eventually turns good. He's a mean, nasty drug dealer from the streets who ends up helping the cop, you know, just your typical bad guy turned good, who's really a good guy at heart. That was one of the original deals that came out with Booker T that never came to fruition. Of those guys that he mentioned, Booker T and Undertaker were two of the best characters that, in my opinion, would have done very well in film. And they're two of the guys that they never really utilized. But it was, you know, from later on, John Cena, Stone Cold Steve Austin. Austin was another one that, good God, with his chops and his name recognition alone, I thought would have done a whole lot better than anything that they did. I truly enjoyed the first movie that we did with him, The Condemned. I thought that was one of the best movies that WWF Studios ever did.
Let's talk a little bit about ribbing the Undertaker. We've talked about this before with the Cucumbers and Owen Hart and Paul Bearer and these guys. But once upon a time, Booker T got one over with the Spinneroonie. Can you catch us up on this story? Because this is a story that a lot of us have heard about. And then some of us have even seen on DVD as an extra, but you were there. What do you remember about the Taker-Rooney?
One of the, I guess, things you would strive for as a talent is to break the unbreakable. And Undertaker would be one of those unbreakables that he didn't bust in the ring. He rarely, you know, wouldn't break character. So if you could get Taker to break character in the ring, that was a victory. It was an internal victory. You felt good about it. And that's what we attempted to do here with the Taker-Rooney. Every night when Booker T would finish up, Booker T would have whoever around, whether it be a tag match or whatever, everybody to do their version of a Spinneroonie. And this one night, without smartening Taker up, Taker went to exit, and we got word to Booker, hey, man, get Taker back in the ring and call him out, basically try to get him to do a Taker-Rooney. And Taker refused and refused and refused. And finally, he got the hell out. Rock, yeah, whoever came out. But yeah, it was, we broke him. We broke him.
So at this point, you know, Booker T is in the ring, supposed to be competing in a match. And Undertaker says he's not lit. The fans aren't leaving until they see a Spinneroonie. Booker T turns it on him, says he needs to see a Taker-Rooney, and one by one, The Rock, Hunter, Vince McMahon, everybody comes out and does their own Spinneroonie in an effort to make sure that he does it, and he didn't do it. How long did you guys rag on The Undertaker for refusing to do a Taker-Rooney?
Not too long, out of fear and respect, but it was positively classic. And the more people that came out, and the more people that tried to get Undertaker to do the Taker-Rooney, I think the further in that he dug his heels in, that he wasn't going to do it. That now he was going to basically be in control and say, "Okay, what else you got back there?"
Supposedly,
I ain't doing it.
Supposedly, this goes like 40 minutes.
Yes, that would probably be a kind estimate.
Do you remember ever seeing a Taker-Rooney ever?
No. Saw Shakespeare-Rooney, but that was as close as you were ever going to get.
What's a Shakespeare-Rooney?
A Shakespeare Rooney is when Undertaker kind of kneels on one knee and holds the hand up, you know, the Shakespeare pose. But no, he wouldn't go any further than that. And really, the Shakespeare is kind of how Booker starts off the Spinneroonie. So, yeah, it that was about as close as you were going to get to a Taker-Rooney.
Let's get to the actual show itself. SummerSlam 2002. When I watched it this week, I kind of forgot that they had JR and Lawler calling the Raw matches and Michael Cole and Taz calling the SmackDown matches. Cole and Taz are down by the ring. JR and King are up on the platform near the TitanTron. How does that work? You guys draw straws for that, or how does that go down?
Well, no, that was the way that the TV shows were set up at the time. SmackDown announcers were at the ring, and for Raw, they were up on the platform. We didn't have the Raw announcers at ringside at that time for Raw. So they were in their usual announced positions.
Okay, I'm with you on that. So let me ask another way. As far as who is going to be where, not on the pay-per-view, but on the TV show, does Jim Ross prefer to be on the platform and Taz prefer to be ringside? How is that delegated on the television shows?
It was only to be different between the two shows.
Sure.
Jim Ross preferred to be ringside. I think any great commentator or play-by-play guy wants to be right in the middle of the action. And being at ringside, you're right there and you feel it. The further you're removed from the action, the less you can feel it.
I kind of imagined you were going to say that, and here's the reason I ask. It feels like something where JR would campaign to be ringside, and everybody else would say, I'll do it wherever you want me to. And just to be Vince says, cool, put JR on the platform.
I wouldn't doubt that may happen at some point. At this point in time, it was strictly a form of how they had it on those separate shows.
Well, was JR difficult to deal with in a situation like this where he's not calling the pay-per-view the whole way through? He's only doing his part of the shows. He's not getting to sit where he might like to sit. Any of that a challenge?
No, not really with me. No, JR could grumble and groan sometimes to Kevin Dunn and to production people and to whoever would listen. But for the most part, JR was there to do his job, man. Tell me what you want me to do and I'll go out and do it.
Taz was here rocking a suit, but Michael Cole is in a casual shirt here. Same with JR. When did the dress code for the announced team change and why?
Well, that was kind of in the time of our casual dress. And thank God for Steve Austin that we got away from the suits and we got away from the coats and ties everywhere every day. And we got to just be a little more relaxed. So it was during that time that he felt that the on-air talent could have a little bit more relaxed look as well. But it's funny because that is actually in my notes of how they were dressed. And I thought that just comparing to where we are today and where we were before that, I thought that the guys looked way too casual. In particular, JR and Michael Cole.
Well, the other announcers, the Spanish announce team and the other announcers ringside, some of those guys are just in T-shirts. This just feels way different. You know, you've got black mat and the black barricades and a black ring skirt and black poles and black ropes and black turnbuckles. And everything is much more understated here than the kind of over-the-top presentation that we get now. And it feels like Vince's taste just sort of changes as the wind blows. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Cool.
Exactly. And it was the whole black mats and the black barricade was to accentuate the ring. And the ring being with the light blue apron, that was to accentuate the wrestlers and the action in the ring. And if you can dull everything else out around it, then it brings your attention to what you want the attention to be, and that's on the talent in the ring.
Let's talk about the first match, and what an opener this is. I mean, when you've got Rey Mysterio Jr. and Kurt Angle working in your opener, that tells you how stacked this card is going to be. The crowd was super hot for this. There's one spot in particular they loved where Ray was flipping over the ref onto Angle on the floor, and the crowd's just super hot for it. Lots of crazy stuff going on here. There is a spot somewhere in here where He hits the 619 and manages to not get the pin. Even after the West Coast pop, he goes for a top rope maneuver. Ultimately, that winds up in a submission, and he winds up tapping out. And this was Rey Mysterio's pay-per-view debut. Mysterio had just debuted in the company in June, and this is well after the invasion angle had started. I'm sure we'll talk about him again another time in long form, but catch me up. Why did Rey not come in with everybody else the year prior? Why the delay here? And ultimately, why was it the right call to have him make his pay-per-view debut but go out with a loss?
The reason that Rey didn't come in a year before with everybody else was because Rey had a great contract with WCW, and Rey opted to go ahead and wait out and get his contract paid out. So it was a lucrative contract. I don't blame him for doing that. He chose to stay home during that time. So Rey coming in here, his debut, in my opinion, what better way to debut than against a guy like Kurt Angle? And the match itself, off the chart, the innovativeness of Kurt Angle being able to take a guy like Rey Mysterio. And I thought that Kurt made Rey shine and made him a mega superstar in this match. And in addition to, you know, just making him that mega star, being able to hang with a guy like Kurt Angle, I felt that the tap out right in the middle of the ring was the right thing to do, because people believed it. And the way that they worked the match and the way that they told the story of the underdog Rey was just absolutely masterfully done. And I think that it got Rey over more than if Rey had come in there and beat Kurt. I don't think people would have believed it at that time.
Well, it's just curious that you guys would book him against this type of opponent right away, but it is a credit to Kurt, because Rey did get all of his hot moves in. He did make him look good, but he didn't go down to the finisher. Was Vince kind of on the fence as to what Rey's upside might be? Of course, we would know he would go on to win the world title, but was Vince still with his old school, he's so tiny attitude at the time?
Well, yes. And you add to the fact that Vince's reaction to Eddie Guerrero several years before that was, he's so tiny, he's a little fella. Now you bring in basically Eddie's baby brother,
this little guy, what the hell can he do? And I can't see his face. What the hell does he look like? He's a cute little guy.
I think it took time for Rey to kind of win Vince over and win over the WWE audience too.
So chat me up. When Rey is finished up with WCW, he's not wearing a mask. He comes in here wearing a mask, but you just kind of, and I'm sure you're doing it tongue in cheek, you're referencing that Vince said you couldn't see him because he's wearing a mask. The whole idea behind wearing the mask is to sell a shit ton of merchandise, right? I mean, that feels like a Vince call all day.
No, Vince hates masks and just he didn't see it. He didn't like the mask. The sell on it was, to those of us that understood the lucha side of the business, it's a heritage, and you can tell this story of the luchador and the mask, and felt that a guy like Rey, with his legacy in the business, that was something that we could capitalize on. And that's a tough sell to Vince, because Vince wants to recreate everything and own everything. So he doesn't want something that has been used and done before. He doesn't want somebody that owns their name and that has established their name somewhere else. So it was a tough call, and it was an uphill battle for Rey, but he was able to do it. And that was one of the selling points, was being able to say, good God, look at the merchandising that you can do with kids wanting to wear this Rey Mysterio mask. And kids could identify with Rey because of his size. And the other selling point was, hey, Vince, we got your Mighty Mouse. He can be Mighty Mouse. Look at that cute little Mighty Mouse motherfucker. And again, he eventually got sold.
So I find it interesting you talk about Rey's history in the business, but you guys actually wind up dropping the Junior from his name. Is that because Vince hated being called Junior? Or if you're trying to embrace the history of Rey, why would you drop the Junior?
Well, Vince does hate juniors. Vince hates juniors just in general and feels that junior is less than. And Vince wasn't a junior. That's just how people referred to him. And he hated that. And I think that when people, John Meekum, who his dad was John Meekum Jr., okay, a friend of mine. He was the original owner of the New Orleans Saints. His dad, John Meekum Sr., was one of the first big four oil tycoons in the world. And Meekum always hated the junior because he felt it was less than. And Vince felt that same way, that a man should be a man. He has a name. He's not junior. Junior's a kid. And just didn't like it.
I'm curious to hear what Kurt Angle thought about working against Ray here. I ask because he's in the opening match, and a year prior to this, he was in the main event for the world title. Any sort of pushback from Kurt over his positioning here?
Not at all. No, you got to understand, Connor, the opening match is a feature position. It's the very first thing. It sets the tone for the show.
Okay, I get that. I'm just curious. Why did Stone Cold and The Rock never open a show? It's a featured match.
They did.
When?
Sure they did. All throughout their career. Both of them opened shows.
Not once they were in the title picture.
Well, no, not when they were in the title picture, but they've all opened. So it's a feature. John Cena just opened up a pay-per-view the other night.
All right. Let's talk about, I guess, the elephant in the room. Is this just the old traditional rumor and innuendo? We've all heard this. The WWF guy has to beat the WCW guy in the big match. Can you defend and say that's not what this was?
No, it's not what this was.
Can you think of a time when a WCW guy, a WCW creation that was a big star there, beat a WWF guy in his first big pay-per-view right off the top?
I have no idea. Not off the top of my head. I don't remember. If I had a whole list of stuff in front of me, I could probably come up with something, but no. Off the top of my head, no. I just watched this show, Conrad. I didn't go back and do a study of every pay-per-view in the history of pay-per-views.
You can look at them all because it never happened, brother. What do you think of the match? In the dirt sheets, it got 3 3/4 stars. What say you?
Well, if it was in the Tokyo Dome, it would have gotten...
Oh, goddamn. How many times are we going to do that joke? What do you think of the fucking match?
Because, goddammit, I don't give a shit about his star rating. I thought that the match...
I asked what you thought. Okay, thank you.
I know. I thought that the match was positively excellent. And I kept writing down about great psychology and great story, but that was a theme of this entire night. And this damn thing set it off. And again, Ray selling in this particular event was another lesson in how young baby faces could learn how to sell and get a crowd. And it was masterfully done on the part of Rey Mysterio.
Well, and I think Kurt Angle doesn't nearly get the credit he deserves. And these days, of course, he's the GM, but I think a lot of younger fans have forgot just how off the charts he was. Think of the type of match he would have with a Steve Austin or a Triple H or even a Brock. And now here, this type of match that he's doing with Mysterio, it almost feels like Kurt Angle can do anything he wants.
That's because Kurt Angle can do anything. And Kurt Angle is one of those talent that can adapt to his opponent. So Kurt Angle, when you worked with Kurt Angle, you didn't have Kurt Angle's match. Kurt Angle made the match that you had with him unique to you. So every opponent that worked with Kurt, their matches didn't have to be Kurt Angle's matches. He was able to adapt and make his opponents look better than they ever could have on their own.
Next up, we see Stephanie walking into her dressing room, and the Raw GM, Eric Bischoff, is there sitting on her couch, and they have decided to share an office here, and they're going to watch the rest of the event together. This is the stereotypical GM office at the time. A couple of posters, some of them are backlit from below, a fake tree in the corner, a couple of black leather couches. Who put this together and whose job was to set up this dummy GM studio every single show?
That beautiful ficus tree?
Yeah.
That traveled the entire world, by God? You got to love the ficus. Richie Posner is the one who originally designed all of that. And everywhere we went, the idea, Vince wanted the damn general manager's office to look the same every time so that it was the same office. It's got to be the same. It just God, with the pipe and drape sometimes, some buildings, they just look like ass. And Nassau Coliseum backstage looks like ass. And that's what this was. But I produced all of these, and we did them live. And this was not the best night for Eric Bischoff and Stephanie, in my opinion. I felt that they just were kind of – if you go back and watch it, there's almost like a hesitation between the two of them on everything they do. They're waiting. It's almost like they're counting, waiting for a reaction. And the chemistry or lack thereof between them was real. But watching it 15 years later seemed off to me.
Do you think that you did these live because you're lazy as shit and just wanted to do everything live so you didn't have to do it over and over? I mean, that's what the rumor and innuendo on you is.
Oh, okay. I like doing everything live. And here's the reason I like doing everything live, because you can't redo it. And when you are doing it live, there's an energy about it. And there is a definite feeling of liveness in anticipation that anything can happen. And whatever the fuck does happen is real. And if you pre-tape shit to ad nauseum, it comes across that it's been pre-taped and overproduced till it's just the drizzling shit. So fuck you and fuck anybody else.
I love when
because
I get you.
You know why? Because what? I can produce live, and I'm good enough that I can fucking do it. And some people can't because they're not good enough to produce live. Because they're afraid, because they want the net. They want to pre-tape it so that it's perfect and pretty, because they can't handle the stress of doing it live. That's when I excel, is when I'm live and I don't have a net.
I'd invite everybody to rewind about 2 minutes where Bruce said that this segment was not very good.
No, all of them that night were not very good.
And who produced them all?
I did.
Live.
Yep.
Okay.
It wouldn't have been any – no, it wouldn't have been any better. Trust me, it would not have been any better pre-taped.
Oh, because you're just terrible at your job. Got it. Taped or live. Yeah,
that's it. I suck.
I mean, Jim Cornette agrees.
Hey, thanks for coming, folks. 12th podcast of the year here in Anaheim, California, and I greatly appreciate all your support, and thanks so much.
We're not winning this yet back-to-back. We have to have Tony win it next year. Hey, so let's get to the next match. Ric Flair, Chris Jericho, what a phenomenal, I don't know, surprise. I kind of forgot this match was even here, but it's a pretty fun match. The match actually gets about 3 stars in the dirt sheets. It's kind of weird when I watch this back, though, that Ric had his original WWF theme music from 1991. Any guess as to why that might be? Because for so much of this era Ric Flair stuff, we get the real theme, but right here, not so much.
I don't know. I don't know what that issue is with the network and what, when they change out some music and some music they don't, they change out. I have no idea. It's probably just a licensing issue.
What led to this, of course, is Flair was doing a backstage interview on Raw and Jericho attacked him and Flair got some color. Well, then later in the show, Jericho's band Fozzy is performing on Raw and Flair comes out and knocks over the musical equipment. And this is all happening, of course, during a time where we're seeing Jericho make a really big push for his band Fozzy. And we've never really talked about Fozzy before here on the show. What did Vince think of Chris Jericho as a rock star and specifically his band Fozzy?
What's with this Fozzy shit? I don't get it. Does he want to be a wrestler or a singer?
Vince didn't really get it, but it was an opportunity to let Jericho do something else and change up his character somewhat. So why not give it a try? And if Chris was successful with it, it benefits WWE and vice versa. So why not try it and just was able to change up the Jericho character somewhat and still staying true to the Y2J character. But I remember... I remember Flair going out trying to beat up the set when he attacked Jericho on
that
the
was
set.
Super fun. I dug that.
Fun or funny? It was hilarious because I remember going back and Rick having the damnedest time trying to knock things over and destroy it, and things are bouncing back on him. And they did a masterful job of editing it in the package that made it look fun. But this was Rick at his best, in my opinion, just being crazy Rick and kind of out of control, but also, especially in the match, being in control of the match, setting the pace and taking Jericho on a nice little ride. And it was nostalgic to just go back and help everyone understand why Ric Flair can be regarded in many people's opinion as the greatest of all time. Because even at this age, Rick was still out there able to hang. Some things he shouldn't have been doing, and some things here was a guy, think about this, Conrad. 2 years before that, was embarrassed to take his shirt off
right
on television, and was out there hanging with this kid and making the kid look like $1 million.
And it's got to be a pretty big deal, because you've referenced it already. Flair's 53. He doesn't come back until November of 01, but he gets talked into wrestling Vince at the Rumble in 02, then has the big match with The Undertaker at WrestleMania. He's teaming with The Big Show to face Steve Austin at Judgment Day. He's working Eddie Guerrero at King of the Ring. I mean, so he's putting together some big name matches through 2002, and he allegedly didn't even have a lot of confidence in himself or his work or his performance or his appearance or any of that here. When it comes out that Flair's supposed to go over, McMahon tells Jericho that Flair's going to win with an inside cradle, and Jericho wants to lose with the figure four, since Flair at this time was losing or winning so rarely with it. According to Jericho, Flair disagreed with that suggestion and said he didn't deserve to win that way because he wasn't himself. So this leads to the scene of Jericho actually giving Flair a pep talk, making him realize that he's Ric Flair and that he deserves the best for himself. Do you remember there being some sort of hubbub about the finish here?
Well, the hubbub was Jericho's right. The Vince wanted Flair to catch him with a quick one, Flair catching Jericho with a quick one. And Jericho made the suggestion. It's like, you know, and go back, you know, here's one for you. Go back and tell me how many pay-per-views Ric Flair has ever won with figure four.
Not a lot.
I don't think he's ever won any. So here was Ric Flair's finisher that he never beat anybody with. And it was Jericho's like, if he's going to beat me with your finish. And it just goes again to show, as I stated over a year ago when we started doing this, and I was talking about current product and saying Chris Jericho is the best out there. This was the seeds of that, and Jericho understanding how to get people over, how to get himself over. And at the time, Rick, as you've stated several times, Rick was a shadow of himself, extremely insecure, didn't believe in himself, and was second-guessing everything. And it was an opportunity to say, you know what, you're Ric Flair, go out and beat him with your finish. And I thought it worked great. It was the right call and the right thing to do, and it worked.
No, it absolutely worked. And it's an underrated match. And you see Jericho here pulling out all the stops. Jericho had obviously been a student of the game, growing up a big wrestling fan. And I imagine is pretty excited about being in a match like this here, because just a few years prior, Flair was a top guy in WCW, and Jericho sort of felt like he was being held down. Did you ever have a conversation with Jericho about him being excited to work with Flair here?
Yes. Good God. It's Ric Flair.
Right.
It's no different than Undertaker going to Vince and saying, I want to work with Flair at WrestleMania. He was Ric Flair.
Right.
And the other part that kind of went through my mind is here Rick is at 53 years old, and I'm going back. This is 2002. Go back to 1992 when Vince felt at 43 years old that Rick was too old for the WWF and that he wanted Rick to get a facelift. And here we are 10 years later.
He's still there.
Rick's going over this kid in Jericho with the figure four.
And he's going over right now in Atlanta. Shout out to Rick, and obviously prayers are with the family. Is he still,
hey Rick, I love you.
Still trying to reverse that figure four down there in Atlanta. We're pulling for you, bud. Let's talk about Charles Robinson. What was the rap on Charles? Would Rick request him for most of his big matches? It feels like he did a lot of big matches for Sean and for Rick, but we're seeing less and less of him these days. You know, why do you think that is? Can you freestyle a guess? And can you tell us, you know, who was a big fan of Charles and who had campaigned for him?
Charles was a great referee, and Charles, there's certain guys that work better with other guys. So Flair and Charles actually, you know, they had a rapport for a long time going back to WCW and also Jericho. So it's a logical, when you have a referee that you enjoy working with that knows, it's like dancing. Whoever you're working with in the ring, you like working with a certain guy, you want to work with them a lot. Same thing with the referee. If referee knows your moves, knows your mannerisms, you want that referee in the ring versus having to call everything with a new referee who's in the wrong place, doesn't know your moves. So Rick definitely loved working with Charles. So we tried to match up referees with the talent in the ring. And if you notice, that's kind of the norm. You'll see the same referee with the same guys an awful lot.
Overall, you know, this 2002 year is pretty critical for Rick. What was the general impression from the office about Rick's performances in 2002? I mean, he's working with Big Show, Austin, Vince, Undertaker, Eddie Guerrero, Chris Jericho. He's got all the big names here. Is this, at the time, did it feel like maybe this is Vince's opportunity to let Rick have his last hurrah? Little did we know he would keep going. Or what was the takeaway?
Yes. To answer your question, in Vince's mind, this was, you know, give Rick a year, maybe a year and a half, put him back in the ring, let him get kind of a nice little farewell, one last hurrah before he hangs the boots up and goes away.
Right.
And we would have him as an on-air character. We would use him as an ambassador, goodwill ambassador outside of the ring, and continue to be Ric Flair.
Little
was a way to just get him out there.
Little did we know he still had a half a dozen more years in him, and he'd keep going. Somebody else who would keep going is Paul Heyman. He's doing a promo backstage with Brock here, and he's referring to him as the next big thing. Whose idea was that for Paul Heyman to be paired with Brock? And then most importantly, for him to be called the next big thing? That sounds like a Paul Heyman idea. What did it sound like when he pitched it?
100% Mr. Heyman's idea, sir, because Brock Lesnar is the next big thing. And the only person to handle his career going forward would be me, but I will not be an agent. I will be an advisor.
Thank you. Let's volley on over to Edge, Eddie Guerrero. I can't believe this is this card, man. So far we've had Ray and Kurt, and then we had Flair and Jericho, and now we've got Edge and Eddie. I'm curious, because this is an era of Edge where he's not really the main eventer, but he's no longer the tag guy. He's trying to make a name as a single. He's scooting to the ring here in a new white trench coat. The dirt sheets at the time, right? I'm not sure what it is, but he is just missing something as a worker. And unless he finds it, I don't think the people are ever going to buy him as a top guy. That's what Brian Alvarez wrote about him. What did you think of Edge here at this time? Obviously, we know that Brian would prove to be incorrect, or maybe he says Edge found it, but Edge certainly became a top guy. But this character Edge right here does sort of feel like he's not really sure who he is. Your thoughts?
Edge wasn't sure who he was, but I will say this about Edge. From day one, he had it.
Right.
And he had that intangible it that was special, that we did know that he was going to be a top guy. There was just time getting him to that place. And I think that, just a sidebar, the light bulb with Edge was when we put him with Vicky Guerrero, in my opinion. I thought that was
what leveled him up.
Oh my God. He went into Heath Ledger mode. He became that character. He lived it. He breathed it. And that took him over the edge. And it was during, get that? See, I did that.
Yeah.
Took Edge over the edge. But this was just a time that he was coming into his own, and we knew that there was something there. And just looking to find it and hoping it was going to come out here.
This is one of those really, really great matches to me, because we see these guys really work on a body part, and maybe that's the old school fan in me, but they're trying to tell a story here with Edge's shoulder. And I thought it was phenomenal. It gets 3 stars from Alvarez. I thought it was great though. There's a spot here somewhere in there where Edge and Eddie are on the top rope and Edge shoves him, or Edge gets shoved off. And he lands on the bad shoulder, and then Eddie does a splash on the bad shoulder. And Taz even says, Jesus. And it's just awesome because they're doing such a great job of selling, hey man, he can't hang on here. When all of a sudden, seemingly out of nowhere, Edge hits the spear and gets the pin. A great story. I love the match. It really highlighted what a great performer Eddie Guerrero was to me. What'd you think?
It was logical. Everything that they did in the match was logical. And they told the story from beginning to end. And this brought me back to the time, and I'll say this publicly, I love Michael Cole, but I absolutely, positively hate the fact that Michael Cole calls Eddie Guerrero,
right?
Vicky Guerrera, Chavo Guerrera. It's Guerrero. And Michael's wife is Hispanic. He should know this stuff, but he just had a mental blank with the Guerrero name. I guess he must have had a Guerrera somewhere in his past that he just couldn't get it out. But that drove me nuts throughout this entire match. The match was logical and told a beautiful story. And the commentators, I thought, told a beautiful story as well. They knew what the hell they were talking about, and they knew what they had to get across. And again, go study this match. You want to be a wrestler? You want to learn how to tell a story inside the ring when the bell rings? This is a beautiful one.
You know, it's funny because you can't see my notes here on this side, and I swear I wrote, this seems like a great match to recommend to aspiring wrestlers to watch because, you know, they manage to have an incredible match where they tell a story and work a body part, but they still get all their high spots in. So it doesn't have to just be Ole Anderson working a shoulder. You can do some other crazy shit in there too and still tell a story, and that's what they did here. Let me ask you here, it was at this point Eddie Guerrero almost like the gatekeeper to being a top guy. It feels like this is a little bit of a test to see, hey, what does Eddie think about him? Can Eddie get a good match out of him? Can Eddie get a top guy match out of him? Because we would continue to see his career kind of go up. But if this match would have been a stinker, does Edge's career look the same, or is this kind of the litmus test of sorts?
Without it actually being a litmus test, yes, it was. Because if you get out there and you're going to stink the joint out with Eddie Guerrero, then you cannot have a good match. So, yes, there was a lot of onus on Eddie to get the very best out of him. And if you can hang, then we know you can hang. But if you're going to go out there and stink it up, then by God, maybe there's no hope. Yes and no. It just was two great guys together with a good story.
On the way here, of course, Edge had won the King of the Ring the prior year, so he had a little bit of momentum for a while as a singles worker. Since Eddie had come back to the WWE a few months prior, he had already won and lost the Intercontinental title to RVD. He was starting a feud with Steve Austin before Austin walked out. He worked in the King of the Ring against Ric Flair. So these guys are both very active, but it feels like one of these guys is going to be leveled up, and that night it was Edge. And I do think it's funny that, you know, we're in the middle of talking about this and you say, hey, the way he became a top guy to me is working with Eddie's wife. Isn't that awesome?
It all comes around.
Next up, we see the promo for Our Season Never Ends. This is a commercial right in the middle of a pay-per-view. At the time, there's some rumblings that Major League Baseball may be going on strike. And we may not have baseball that season. Whose idea was it to push this and do it on pay-per-view, in fact?
Well, it was a campaign we were doing on television. It was the campaign at the time to just show everybody, hey, they're going to leave you, and they don't care about you, the fans. They're more worried about their contracts, and they're more worried about themselves. We're worried about the fans. Our season never ends. We will always be here for you 52 weeks a year, 365 days a year, and you can always count on us, by God.
Well, unless you walk out. Next up, we've got the evil Canadians, the un-Americans, taking on Booker T and Goldust. the un-Americans, help me understand. You know, I know that I'm going to get some shit for this, but it's Test, Christian, and Lance, and it's an underrated group, in my opinion. I kind of dug this. I kind of dug the guys. I didn't really understand the upside down flag and doing a no two. That feels a little bit like poor taste. But I think some of these guys are just criminally underrated. How did it come together? Whose idea was it? And in your opinion, was this really just kind of piggybacking Brett's 1997 angle on some level?
They're un-Americans. Regal was also going to be a part of this group as well. The idea behind it, it was Vince's idea. He loved it. Vince loves anything that is, you know, nationalist and show your American pride and America. We're America. And America hates foreigners, especially those damn Canadians, you know, especially after that war that we had, you know, there with Canada and all the horrible stuff that they did to us. But Vince gets caught up in us versus them an awful lot.
Right.
And it was an opportunity to take some guys that he really didn't know what to do with.
Right.
And let's throw some heat on them. You couldn't. At that time, we eventually ended up doing it, but you couldn't go and get a Middle Easterner and do that. So we'll do it with Canadians, and they'll just bash America because America hates that. The problem was that what was being written for these guys was some pretty heavy stuff. And Christian and Test both lived in Tampa and were American citizens. I think they're American citizens, but I don't know, both now they're all Canadian, but they were afraid of the heat. They didn't, maybe afraid's the wrong word, but they did not embrace the heat. They did not relish going out there and saying these things, even though it is, you know, it's fiction. You're just playing a part. You're reading someone else's words, someone else's idea. You're going out and portraying something else. We know you're not really un-American. We know you really don't hate America, but go out and play this part and get people to hate you and to boo you. Those guys didn't like that. They were uncomfortable with that. So the words, when they said them, they did not ring true. They didn't ring true to them. They didn't ring true to the audience. And it was a fart in church. Regal was the only guy that was interested in really going out and getting heat.
I mean, do you think this was, you know, I mean, you're on board with this upside down flag business just a year after September 11?
No, I hated it. Absolutely hated it. I hated the whole un-American, gimmick and idea because, again, the country was unified at this time.
Right.
And for once, America was feeling good about themselves. And like I said, because they're feeling good about themselves, do you go out? Do you find an Osama bin Laden type character? No, that's too close to home. Don't want to do that. But go out and find someone anti-American and we'll hate them because we're so unified. It just felt that that type of heel and that type of storyline had run its course. I just think that the business was beyond that, especially at this point.
Did you think that in 97 when you brought the Sultan in, or did you think that in 91 when you did the Slaughter thing? When did
91, I was 100% on board with that.
When did it jump the shark for you?
Here.
Okay.
I'll tell you why, because it was the first time that America had ever really been attacked on the mainland.
Right.
Like that. So and it was fresh and it was still new. America had never been attacked. We'd never had anybody come in and do that on our soil, our mainland. Yes, they did it in Hawaii, but this was brand new, man. It was still fresh. And I just thought it was just too far, too much, too far, too soon.
I'm a big Lance Storm fan. I always enjoyed his matches, but I feel like Vince had a strong opinion one way or another. Did Vince have a Lance Storm impression or a takeaway, or what did Vince think of Lance?
Yeah.
match over yet?
All right, so let me ask you, Bruce Pritchard. You thought Lance's matches were boring?
I think Vince felt Lance was boring.
But that was kind of his gimmick, right? I mean, his gimmick was to be that way.
Okay, that's his gimmick. He did it well.
No, I'm just saying.
I don't think a boring gimmick is something that is going to sell a lot of tickets, in my opinion. I thought that Lance, bell to bell, excellent.
I mean, hard to beat. I mean, the guy's outstanding. I guess I meant in terms of, you know, he's not putting on silly face paint and he's not doing, you know, ridiculous screaming promos. He was very about his business, and I thought it was kind of old school. I dug Lance Storm. Well, what did he think about Christian? What did Vince think about Christian?
Vince felt that we should put a blue dot on Christian's face and have the blue dot follow him around wherever he was in the match or whenever he did promos.
Are you fucking serious?
Just get a big blue dot. What's that thing that they do when they have the people up on the newsstand in the courtroom, you know, and the jury, and they put blue dots on their face. Someone testifies and you don't want to see their face. It's a blue dot. Blech. I'll put a blue dot on him. Now it's going to be some tricky editing there, but just get a blue dot.
That's what he thought.
This is real life right now.
Oh, you can't make that one up.
He actually pitched putting a fucking blue dot on one of his own contracted performers' faces.
More than seven times, yeah.
That'll get him over.
Who kept talking him out of that?
The reality of trying to logistically do it.
Oh, so nobody was like, oh, don't do that to Christian. It was just, fuck, boss, that's a lot of work. Can we not?
Man. Yeah, it's like, geez, this could add like.
How about a blue mask? Can we just do like a blue mask?
No, it's got to be a dot. I'll be able to see his eyes and his nose through a mask. I want a dot.
Do you think Christian knows this story?
I don't know if he does or not. I'm sure he does by now, sure. It's been out there. I mean, this is in Revelation.
A blue dot.
Blue dot.
He's Christian's fucking rolling back prices, I guess.
And I will say this about Christian. From when Christian and Edge came in at the same time into our developmental system and we saw them and spent a week with them, I used to say, and this probably helped kill Christian in the beginning, I used to say, you know, in my opinion, Christian was probably for a long time the best pure worker on the roster.
Wow.
That son of a bitch could do any and everything. He was believable. He was smooth. Loved his work. And I thought, and my praise probably just bit him in the ass from the get-go. And then later on, once, you know, I thought he did well for himself. I was thoroughly entertained by Christian for many years, but I thought that you put somebody in the ring with Jay, he was going to get everything out of him.
That seems like that's a t-shirt from blue dot to champion, because he would go on to be world champion. And so let me ask, on the blue dot, did Vince just think that Christian didn't have any charisma, or that he didn't like his work? He thought he was boring. Did he not like his face?
He just felt that he had no personality.
That's amazing.
I know.
Well, let's talk about somebody who we know has some personality. How fucking great were Booker T and Goldust together? Goldust had come back earlier this same year. How did he compare here in 02 to the Goldust of old, in your opinion? And what can you tell us about this Goldust-Booker T pairing at the time?
Okay. The Goldust-Booker T pairing is a brainchild of Brian Geeworks. And Brian was entertained by Booker and Goldust. He liked Goldust. He loved the character and liked Dustin an awful lot. And Booker and Goldust together was just instant chemistry, and they could do any and everything. God, their shit was so entertaining. Brian could write something and deliver it to them, and they would perform it to the T. And it was fun. Everybody kind of looked forward to it. So I think that it was a time that people got to see the acting chops. And you know, you're talking about earlier, the WWF studios and Booker T, the stuff that he was doing with Goldust was the reason that Vince saw,
God damn, he's a star. Look at him.
And
chocolate all over. Chocolate muscles. Yes. Vascular. Creamy.
Oh, sorry. But it was this time, and I thought that the guys had great chemistry. They enjoyed each other, and two great workers. I think that they both were able to breathe life into one another.
The match is pretty fun. I enjoyed it. It got 3 stars from Alvarez. He would write, a very old school tag match. Booker finally got the hot tag and ran wild. Sure enough, this meant it was time for Test to hit the ring. Ref took a bump. Booker hit the axe kick on Storm and Christian. Then Test killed him with the kick of doom. Christian got the cover and pinfall when the ref woke up. Loud boos for that. What'd you think of the match? I thought it was a pretty fun match for what it was, but then again, I enjoy the Un-Americans.
Okay. Worst match of the card.
Really?
Tells you how great the card is.
Right.
Look at the guys involved in this. Goldust, Booker, Lance, and Christian. It was a great match. It was old school. They told a simple story. So for this to be the worst match on the card speaks volumes to everybody else, because this was a damn good match. Well, you can sit back and go, damn, there wasn't anything that I wouldn't want to see again.
Let me ask you this. Goldust as an in-ring performer, 1995 or 2002?
95.
1995 or 2017?
17.
Isn't that crazy? 22 years later.
Yeah.
The concerto was a big deal around this time, and they're teasing one here. Any memories of one going awry? This feels like something that if you don't do it right, you could really hurt somebody.
Well, I wouldn't let anybody but Edge and Christian do it to me. But I don't think that I cannot ever remember one going awry. And it was safe enough with those two guys doing it, guys that allowed them to do it, trusted them. So fortunately, knock on wood, you know, no one ever got hurt doing it.
You know, I know we referenced the Spinneroonie earlier with The Undertaker, but seeing Booker try to work one into a match here with the Spinneroonie, it made me wonder, and this is around the same time, of course, that we've got the People's Elbow and some other kind of silly moves in wrestling, and we're on the heels of the Worm. Was Vince a fan of the Spinneroonie? This feels like something he would have had trouble pronouncing.
Spinneroonie. What's so damn hard about that?
It just feels like he wouldn't have remembered it. My apologies. I was trying to be funny. You're clearly not in the mood.
You know, no, it's he looked at it as,
God, look at him go. He does the spinny thing in the Rooney. Yeah, gotta love it.
There we go. That's what I was looking for.
I love those Roonies. I don't like it when they put cheese on it, though. Cornette used to smother his in cheese.
Speaking of smothered in cheese, talk me through the makeout contest with Nydia at WWF New York. This is one of the most interesting things on WWE pay-per-view. And I guess as you're talking about it, I'm going to need you to wrap us up here talking about this with you doing an impression of Jamie Noble promoting the kiss here. My God, this was hilarious. It just feels like something Vince McMahon would love.
Woo.
If you haven't already, kids, go watch this Jamie Noble Nydia at WWF New York makeout contest. It's something to
see. Come on, baby. Come on, baby. Get your tongue down up in there. Get your tongue out there. Get that tongue down that boy's throat. Come on, baby. You can do it. Get down there and squeeze you some of them buns, baby. Come on. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I see a little spit going in there. That's what I'm talking about, baby. Save some for later now. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Look at that. Look at that. Oh, yeah. Get that lip lock in there, baby. Ooh.
Oh man. Okay. Jamie.
Let's roll credits. We're done. We're not going to beat that. We're not going to beat that.
Oh, well, Jamie and Nydia and I had gone out to the Playboy Mansion to do some vignettes, because since I don't know when we're ever going to talk about Nitty again, and Hef is there. Now, the Playboy Mansion, this was during a time that they were very friendly to us, and they were letting us do a lot of stuff, and I had a pretty good rapport with the PR guy there. But Hef can be a little eccentric at times. Really, really nice guy, but a little eccentric, believe it or not. So he's home, he's working, he's up in his bedroom, you know, and all this stuff, and they're allowing us to shoot on the outskirts of the house. And the front door, I had Jamie going up and ringing the doorbell and demanding that Hugh Hefner come out and talk to him. And I had a guy inside that was going to answer the door and so on and so forth. And I'm showing Jamie. I said, now, Jamie, when you go up to the door, you just like hit right here. Here's the doorbell. You just push right under it. Don't ring the doorbell because it's a real doorbell. Do not ring the doorbell. Just push right here and raise hell.
You have no, I know you didn't. Now you're going to answer this door right now. My baby, she's going to spread right there for you and all this shit.
Well, Jamie goes up and we're shooting all this. And Jamie goes up and he's actually hitting the doorbell. Well, I don't know this because I'm watching a monitor and I can't see the actual button from the way we're shooting it. And all of a sudden, Hefner's personal security guy comes to the door. And opens the door, and he is livid because Jamie has been sitting there hitting the doorbell, ringing the doorbell. Hef is upstairs in his bedroom on a conference call, and he's hearing the ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, just over and over. And then through the window, he can hear this, hey, I know you in there, you Hefner. I'm going to get you out here. When you get out here, you're going to look at my baby's titties, and he's going to love her. And when she spreads that thing, you just going to have it in your magazine because my God, my baby Nitty, she's my beautiful thing. I don't know why you put Tori Wilson in your magazine because I got the hot damn thing for you. And the security guard opens the door, and we almost got thrown out. That took some talking to. But Jamie Noble, man, is a classic. One of the most underrated, underutilized guys in the business.
Well, I don't know if he's...
Here's a guy who, if he had been 6 inches taller and maybe just put 20, 30 more pounds on him, top guy. Top champion forever. Today he would be.
I think he's still one of the champions backstage. It would not surprise me to hear that he's running SmackDown or Raw anytime.
No, that wouldn't shock me at all. Great mind for the business, but talent, just innate, natural talent.
Do you think
get
we
should tongue in there, baby? Get it in there. Come on. You know what to do. This is a normal thing you do.
I think
and backwards. Come on, backwards. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Let me just say that Jamie Noble is my new favorite impression of yours. I didn't know you could do it, but now that I know,
I didn't.
She's going to go ahead and spread that thing for you.
Her arms. Welcome in, baby.
Oh, I love it. Next, if you haven't seen the skit, man, you got to go see it. You're missing out.
I was crying, watching it, laughing, just... That's good shit.
Next up, we see Bischoff and Stephanie in the back, and Bischoff says something to Stephanie like, we'll see who's on top later. That feels like a Brian or Vince line. Who should claim the credit for that?
Me.
Okay, cool.
We're watching it live. We don't know what the hell they're going to do live.
Next up, we've got Benoit coming to the ring, and they have the belt blurred out on the network. What's up with that?
I have no idea, and I didn't even notice that. I saw somebody on Twitter ask that, and I didn't even notice it when I was watching it.
It's really, really weird here. Tony Chimmel is on the announcing duties here and hands the mic to Howard Finkel. I suppose the gimmick here is one's the Raw announcer, one's the SmackDown announcer. It was cool to see Fink call a match here and introduce a guy, but I don't know that a lot of people listening are in the loop on Tony Chimmel's job and how it has evolved. Can you catch everybody up about Chimmel's history with the company?
Tony Chimmel was on the ring crew when I first started in 1987. He was one of the guys that hung out with Joey Morella. He was a friend of Joey Morella's. and Joey Morello's Gorilla Monsoon's son. And those guys always hung out, and they were a part of the ring crew. And as it evolved, Tony was put out in the ring to be a ring announcer one night, did a pretty good job. So they kept him, and he was able to go out and be a friggin' ring announcer. The fact that we actually put him on TV just astonishes me, because Tony ain't a pretty man. And that was always funny, but neither was Howard.
I was going to say, I mean, the other option is Howard. Let's talk about Howard, because Howard's not on TV anymore. How was he phased out? What did that conversation go down like? Whose idea was it? Was it a Vince call? What's he doing with the company these days, as best you know?
These days, I don't know that Howard is doing much of anything beyond working on the WWE.com. I saw him at a convention in New Jersey not long ago and seemed to be very happy and doing well, but he's mainly doing appearances and being Howard. But he still goes into the office every day and goes in and works on WWE.com.
When was he removed?
Howard Finkel. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
When did he get moved out of the ring?
Out of the ring? I guess 2000, right about 2000, when Lillian Garcia, we had hired Lillian Garcia to be a part of, originally we hired her to be a part of a show on Univision, Los Superastros, El Bocadito. And Vince liked her look. And when he saw the other girl that we had for Super Astros, he liked her look better for the on-screen deal. And we put Lillian out to try her out as a ring announcer. So you have Howard Finkel or Lillian Garcia.
Sure.
In 2000. Which one would you rather look at?
Howard.
Okay.
So we've got RVD.
I'm moving to Huntsville, Conrad. You can look at me every day.
All right. RVD gets a win over Chris Benoit here to win the Intercontinental title. Pretty good match here. 3 3/4 is what Alvarez gives it. What'd you think of the match?
Tremendous. They beat the shit out of each other. One, it was solid. And being able to watch, you know, Van Damme, because there were people that looked at Rob as being stiff and being hard to work with. Benoit loved that. Benoit loved you to be stiff, because Chris would be stiff right back with you. And their styles, I felt, meshed very well. It was really, on paper, you would think they would clash and it wouldn't be that great. But going back and watching it, it makes you remember how great Benoit was bell to bell in the ring.
Sure.
And just sit there and say, man, Van Damme, You give Rob somebody that can dish it out and hang with him. I thought he shined in this match. I thought both guys, it played to their strengths.
These guys are working very stiff, as you said, and both have a reputation for working snug. RVD's really laying the kicks in. You got to assume that, as you said, Benoit would ask them to. They're both here with busted, bloody lips. Benoit misses the headbutt off the top, which in hindsight, maybe not the best call. RVD misses the big frog splash. Benoit goes to put the crossface on, but RVD makes the ropes. Eventually, you know, these guys go back and forth doing lots of different flips and Northern Light suplexes. And I mean, there's a lot of big moves going on here. And eventually Benoit gets a crossface and RVD even manages to get out of that. Eventually Benoit goes for a top rope back superplex. But RVD reverses it into a high cross and then hits the frog splash and gets the win clean. Alvarez would write, the total wrong man won this match. Finish came out of nowhere because the ref all of a sudden started rushing them towards the finish, saying they needed to go home. With about 5 more minutes, this would have really been something else. Benoit looked like the best wrestler in the entire world here. What'd you think of that assessment from Alvarez? Did the wrong guy win? I got to say, in hindsight, it did feel like and this is me saying this, not Alvarez. Let's give them an intercontinental title switch at SummerSlam. Was the office split on this, or why was the decision made to put RVD over Benoit here?
Well, first of all, I'd like to know who said that the match was rushed and the referee was telling them to go home.
You don't believe that was the case?
No, it wasn't rushed. It wasn't rushed at all. It was simply a buildup for the match. It was simply a buildup for the finish to get to that spot that everything's going. Guys are going for false finish. And then finally, out of nowhere, bam, he hits the frog splash and he gets him for a three count. That is, I thought the story was beautifully told. And you can debate all day long. The right guy won, the wrong guy won. If Benoit had gone over that, you'd have the same people saying, oh, well, I don't know why they didn't put the title on RVD. And it was a beautiful match with a beautiful story that I thought, you know, got everything across, but it wasn't rushed. I love when these guys sit there and they think that they know what the hell's going on. And
all right, let's move on here. The decision was made a month prior to have Benoit defect over to SmackDown, and he took the IC belt with him. Well, here, the IC belt is coming back to Raw a little after a month later. Was part of the plan here just to keep that belt on Raw, and that's the reason RVD gets the win, more so than which direction are we wanting to go?
Yes.
Okay. Both RVD and Benoit, as we said, both have a reputation for working snug. Do you remember any of the boys having really particularly strong feelings about one or the other? I heard one top guy once say casually to another guy who was working RVD on Raw, oh shit, you're working Van Damme? Get your fucking hands up. do you remember hearing any sort of strong feelings one way or another about the way either guy had a tendency to work snug?
Yeah, and there were some guys that liked it, some guys that didn't. Like I said, Benoit and RVD working with each other, they love it. Jericho and Benoit used to beat the hell out of each other. They had an agreement. Hit me anywhere other than in the nose or the mouth. You hit me anywhere else on my head, I don't care, as hard as you want to. Van Damme had a reputation for having really snug kicks and he would throw them. But anything that Rob gave, Rob would gladly take back. And he's a tough son of a gun that would stand up and go toe to toe with anybody. So it's one thing to just be the guy that likes to dish it out. But if you're not willing to take it, then you don't really deserve to dish it out. But no, some guys like to work a little bit lighter. Some guys like to work snug.
It's funny. The parallels as far as in ring go, that the two guys, Benoit and Guerrero, kind of work together because, ultimately, Guerrero has to miss some time because of some personal issues, and he's away from the company. Well, around that same time is when Chris Benoit has to have neck surgery, and he winds up missing quite a bit of time. So Benoit hadn't been back a terribly long time here. When do you think the decision was made? For different reasons, of course. We can trust these guys, and we're going to push them to the main events because they've kind of been in this mid-card U.S. title, intercontinental title, but now in 18 months, they're both going to be world champs. Carry me through when you remember that sort of becoming the talk of the direction we should go.
Well, for Eddie in particular, it was just kind of came, and that was a battle. For Benoit, it came from having matches with Hunter. And Hunter just loved working with Benoit. He loved the matches. And then Sean came to him, and Sean got involved in the whole thing. And they were like, you know what? What better way to really get Chris over? Have him beat us both. You know, let's go to WrestleMania and put the title on him because people will believe it. It was just a steady, no different than Stone Cold Steve Austin. When Steve Austin first came into the company, he worked every night doing jobs for Shawn Michaels as champion. And his work, every single night, he worked harder than the next guy and would have the best match on the card. Benoit was doing that. Guerrero was doing that every single night. And you can't deny talent. So it was just a progression over time that you sat there and went, those are the guys that people are reacting to because they're having the best matches. And in Eddie's case, his personality, everything that he was given, every issue, every angle, every storyline, he hit it out of the park. And Benoit, everything that you put him in, no matter what it was, no matter who the opponent was, Chris delivered on the in-ring. So you looked at those two guys and said, you know what? Oh, let's give them a chance.
The next night on Raw, and it happens in Madison Square Garden, Rob Van Dam defeated the hardcore champ, Tommy Dreamer. So Rob is at this point unifying both the Intercontinental and the hardcore titles. And that's actually the last time we ever see the hardcore title in the WWE. Why was the hardcore title abolished?
I don't think that Vince ever expected the hardcore title to become what it became in the first place.
Right.
The hardcore title was a gimmick, a one-time gimmick that he was doing with Mankind.
Right.
And the fact that it caught on, he just looked at it like, why do we have hardcore matches? Yuck. And he didn't like the matches, and he felt that it had run its course. Time to move on. And I think that at this point in time, he kind of felt that the hardcore title represented
that ECW crap,
which, as we see later on, will be revived. But he just was sick of it at this time.
After the Benoit RVD match, we again see Steph and Bischoff in the dressing room, and Bischoff is gloating to her about how now she can watch the IC title on Raw. And she does some sort of weird laugh and walks away. What'd you think of the laugh? This laugh just, I don't know why, but it cracked me up. I watched it twice.
And was it any different the second time you watched it?
No, I guess I was thinking, God damn, I hope Bruce produced this horse shit. Because if he did, I'm going to rib him forever.
I did.
So next up, we have got Undertaker Test. And Test is someone who left us too early. Bruce, were you shocked by that, or was he having trouble even during his WWE run?
I was shocked by it, and I don't remember him really having any problems when I was there. So it did shock me, and I hate it any time that someone leaves us before their time, and especially at a young age like that, just tragedy. And Andrew was a great guy. Sucks.
At one point, was Vince high on Test as a top guy? And if that changed, when and why?
Well, yes. Vince was high on Test from the first time that we saw him. And he came into our first developmental with Edge and Christian and Val Venus and all of those guys. The kiss of death with Test was Russo, who, believe it or not, you know, didn't always look at in-ring talent and looked at guys and would have ideas. And he looked at it as, this is acting. I can just put anybody into that spot and they'll work, you know, because I'm such a great writer, bro. Whatever I write, if they do it right, they'll be a star. So he envisioned Test being a part of DX early on.
Wow.
Hunter hated it. Sean hated it. Everybody hated it. And Russo made the comment that he's as big as Kevin Nash, but he's younger and he'll be better. And that, of course, just set Sean and Hunter off. You know, he's no Kevin Nash. And then on top of that, we don't know this from the talent relations side. This is when I was really just doing talent relations and getting in new talent. From my vantage point, I wanted Test and developmental to go out and learn and to get better because he's a big guy, had a lot of potential. He wasn't ready for prime time by any stretch of the imagination. I didn't realize Russo had this idea for him and had already approached people about it. It was like, he can't go, man. He's not ready. He's not seasoned. He's just not ready yet. So he's at TV, he being Test, and I guess Hunter and Sean were talking to him and found out he'd only had like 5 matches in front of people at that time. So 5 matches, and Russo wants to make him a part of DX. He wasn't ready. And so that was just a little backstory on Test. We did think that he had potential. We did think that there was a big upside to him, but he kind of was missing it throughout his career. He never got really to that next level.
But why? When did it change? When did Ben say, nope, he's not a top guy. Stop writing shit for him. We're not doing that.
Probably took a couple years, because the first few years were, you know, Vince, he's still learning.
Right.
And it wasn't fair to him. We put him in a lose-lose situation.
Sure.
Because he wasn't ready, and we put him into a top spot. We put him in a position where there were so many eyeballs on him and everybody was looking for him to fail. So he couldn't win. And then he was against the eight ball coming in. I do think that if he had more seasoning and just more time before he ever made his debut, that it might have been a little bit different. But I think his confidence was shot. And he thought, because he came in that top spot, that he was already there and already over. And he wasn't.
Taker is over here as the American Badass. We haven't touched on this character a whole lot on our show so far. Anything you can tell us about the American Badass character? I'm sure we'll get into it long form, but give us a little bit of the American Badass.
I am American Badass. Watch me dump when I can. I'm a great singer.
Compared to what?
I don't know. The American Badass was just a reinvention for Taker. It was something to get him out of the dead man persona and to be able to let that character grow. I don't think Vince ever saw the Undertaker in its original incarnation being gone forever. But I do believe that Mark saw the American Badass as the character that he wanted to be. He wanted to be the Undertaker, but not having to do the dead man walk and the signature Undertaker stuff, if that makes any sense to you. Undertaker, Mark Calloway, is a motorcycle riding badass son of a gun. And that was the American Badass character was more true to who Mark Calloway is than, I guess, the Undertaker character. And he liked it.
Why do you think the American Badass character didn't resonate with the crowd more? They just missed the old dead man, and that's what they wanted?
They knew the dead man, and that's what they wanted. They wanted their old Undertaker. They wanted the dead man. They wanted the head snap. They wanted the tombstone.
Of course, eventually we get here with all of the Canadians doing a run-in. Taker beats them all up. He dominates everybody. Lots of boots and chair shots, and then ultimately hits Test with the tombstone for the clean pin, and he's celebrating with the flag in the middle of the ring afterwards. So it's a feel-good moment, you know, against the un-Americans with everybody's favorite, the Undertaker. Brian Alvarez gave it 2.25 stars, and I actually agree with him. I thought this was the worst match on the card. I thought the tag match earlier was better. Did you prefer this match even over the tag match? What did you like about it?
I did, because I enjoy watching Taker go back and work. You know, he was doing leapfrogs in the match, and he was working like a wrestler. And that was always fun for me, because I know how much he enjoyed it. So that's probably just my personal preference. And watching that, he worked the arm, and he worked not like the dead man. So that's probably why I enjoyed it. It was a little bit different.
Yeah,
I didn't think it was a bad match at all.
Yeah, he did some moves here. You mentioned a leapfrog, and you see him, you know, climbing the second rope and posing with the American flag. A much different presentation of the Undertaker. What did Vince think of the American Badass in this iteration of Taker?
Vince liked it because it was different, but in the back of Vince's mind was, we're always going back to the Undertaker.
Right.
I just don't think that Vince ever really explain that to Mark. Because in Mark's head, he was the American Badass, and he was going to stay the American Badass. The transition to get him back to the Undertaker, boy, that was a battle. That was a long, and we'll talk about that when we do another Undertaker in longer form over those years. But that took a lot of convincing, and And that was a battle to get him to do it.
How great were the Lance Storm and Christian choke slams from The Undertaker here?
Get some height, baby. Get on up there. Let's see that little skinny ass of yours with a little blue dot on your face. Get up and touch them lights, baby. Let them burn that little honey and go on down. Ooh, that's good. You too, little mullet head. What's that little flat top, little motherfucker in there? Get on up in there.
I know we will talk about him again, but I don't know when we'll talk about Test again. So I got to bring it up here. You know, after the whole wedding angle goes sideways, it certainly feels like when Triple H reveals that Stephanie can't marry Test on Raw because he's already married her in a Vegas drive-through, that they were building towards a big program with Test and Triple H. And you didn't say it earlier, but I feel like when that didn't happen, this is what cuts the knees out from under Test and his run as a top guy. In your opinion, did Triple H, not just when he was young and not ready as a part of DX, but did Triple H crush the career of Test here by not letting that feud happen?
Well, that was why it didn't happen, because he was young. That was the very first introduction of him. And that was the first time that the Test was introduced. He had no right to be in that position. He wasn't ready. And Hunter did not want to work with him. Sean didn't want. Sean didn't want to work with him. Hunter didn't want to work with him because he wasn't ready. But that was the beginning of his career right there.
Well, I guess we'll take it up another day. Let's talk about the video package. Speaking of Hunter, building up Sean and Hunter here, they show some clips from 1997 with DX. And then they show Sean coming back in 02 with the DX shirts and the skit. And ultimately that sets up the pedigree where Triple H gets to turn on his best friend, Shawn Michaels. And there's a great line from Hunter in this package here. I use Shawn to get to the top, just like he used me to stay at the top. I thought this was one of the more well-done packages that were on the pay-per-view. What did you think of the package and the angle to bring Shawn in? And then we'll talk about the behind the scenes.
I thought the package was excellent, and I thought the angle was excellent because it was logical and everybody can understand jealousy and everybody can understand a friendship and a bond getting broken up like that.
The video of someone jumping Shawn from behind and then putting his head through a window, the bloody aftermath, and then the reveal from Shawn enhancing the video and then challenging Hunter to a match at SummerSlam. This feels like, you know, exactly what Vince was talking about in Beyond the Mat. We make movies. What did you think of the whole jumping Shawn Michaels, head through the rental car, enhancing the video, the big great reveal? I thought it was some of the better storytelling, even if it was a little predictable.
Well, here's what you have. You have a guy that we didn't know what we really had in him in Shawn Michaels. This is going to be his one-off, the only match we're going to do. We couldn't do a whole lot physically with him prior to that. So you can't have him work a match on TV. You got to get creative in how you get him involved. And we didn't want the audience to see them have that physicality. So yeah, you got to get creative and get out there with your storytelling. And I thought that it was beautifully done. And again, especially for us, because we had no idea what the hell we had.
Let's kind of talk about the backstage here, because I think everybody knows we're going to cover this at some point long form. DX has been on the poll 9,000 times and they lose every time, but I'm hopeful that they'll win eventually. But the story with Shawn Michaels and Triple H and DX is a fun one. It's been well documented. We'll get there eventually. But Shawn ultimately becomes injured at the Royal Rumble 1998 in a casket match against The Undertaker. He goes over the top, waxes back on the edge of the casket, and supposedly this causes all kinds of back problems. That leads to a rather interesting first quarter in the WWE as we build towards WrestleMania 14. Shawn is not in a good place mentally, physically, or emotionally. Storms out of the press conference and he's gone. And now this is going to be his first match back in the WWE. He has some trials and tribulations personally while he's out. He finds God. He turns his life over. He also had struggled with addiction. There's rumor and innuendo that he showed up under the influence to a WWE show once and kind of showed his ass. And Triple H even tried to put him in his place. And actually, according to the rumor and innuendo, take your pills, Bruce, tries to have Shawn removed. What can you tell us about the time in between? Because I think most people know that Shawn said he was done with wrestling, never coming back, does things that are uncharacteristic of Shawn. He does an RF video shoot interview. He opens a wrestling school. Thank goodness he did. We got, you know, Brian Danielson out of it. And in an effort to build his own promotion, actually works a match that I think people have forgot that went down in April of 2000 for the Texas Wrestling Alliance against Paul Diamond. What was going on in the downtime? Did he really get kicked out of an event? What was the relationship like with Shawn and Vince during this 4-year gap? What was it like with Paul and Shawn, to the best of your understanding?
From my vantage point, there was not a whole lot. I don't remember Shawn getting kicked out. That's totally news to me. Maybe it happened. I have no idea. I wasn't there. Don't remember that. I do remember from time to time when we would be in San Antonio or maybe Austin that Shawn would come by and say hello. That's where Undertaker and I nicknamed him the little Dutch boy when he cut all his hair off and he had kind of a bowl cut. And we didn't even know who the hell it was when we saw him. He had stopped training. He got way out of shape. I had gone down because Shawn had started his wrestling school. So the only interaction that I had with Shawn during that time was, hey, do you have any talent?
Right.
Get anybody that we might want to take a look at. I'd really love to come down and spend a weekend with you and see what you've got. So at first I was met with, no, none of my guys are ready yet. Then eventually he warmed up to the idea and I went to San Antonio. Shawn picked me up and went over to the house and then we went to a show. And then the next day we went out and saw his training class with Rudy Gonzalez there. There was Spanky, Brian Kendrick, there was obviously Daniel Bryan. There was Lance Cade. And I want to say there were four total. I can't remember the fourth one. But he had some really good talent there. And we talked back and forth. And Shawn would get in the ring with these guys. He wouldn't take bumps, but he would show them little things. And I remember after watching him in the ring training these guys, we went to a town that night where he had a little spot show. And I said, man, you know, you've got another one in you. He said, nope, I've wrestled my last match. I'm done. And I said, you know, they all say that, but I'll use the old bruiser and crusher analogy. All you've got to do is go out there and give them the entrance and kick and punch and throw a super kick and they're going to be happy. His mindset was that if Shawn Michaels is going to appear, he has to be Shawn Michaels.
Right.
He's got to be the showstopper. He's got to be the main event. He has got to be the guy they remember, not a fragment of that guy. So he had no desire. He's like, I'm done. I'm not training anymore. And I remember he was eating a huge chocolate chip cookie. And he says, I'm eating chocolate chip cookies. He says, I'm done. I'm not going back in the ring. And then eventually, I don't know, 6 months after that is when he had the street fight that he had in San Antonio for his own promotion. And he was cleaning up his act. You know, we'd heard that he was doing a lot better. He came down and saw us in San Antonio and looked great, completely different than when I had been down and seen him in San Antonio before that. Floated the idea out there. You got one more? Just one. And that's how we got here. Just floated it out there. And he said, yeah, he trusted Hunter. and felt that he and Hunter could have a match, but they wanted to do a street fight so that he would be forgiven and not have to go out and have that Shawn Michaels wrestling match.
So was the idea always to just do the one story here with Triple H and that be it?
Yep. 100%. One match, one time. This is it. He's not coming back. Not going to get another one. This is it.
Any sort of heat that you recall at all between Shawn or Hunter here?
At this point, no. No, at this point, they were excellent. Long lost buds. Happy to be back together.
Hebner is the referee here, and he has a big part in the match where he admonishes Triple H for his behavior. It's not something that we see very often in a match, and it was weird kind of seeing him here because Hebner was such a staple in the WWE, and now not so much. You were there when Hebner was, you know, exiled. Briefly tell us what happened there. We've never talked about it on the show before.
We were in, gosh, somewhere in West Virginia or something like that. I can picture the building. I don't remember the particular name, but there was some kind of story that allegedly Dave and Earl had been selling bootleg WWE merchandise, and they were released. It's one of those stories that has never been told from really either side. And people put, you know, it's all rumor and innuendo. What I just told you, we weren't told. We were got that surmised from Earl later on that's what they were accused of doing.
There's rumor and innuendo out there that the Hebners were actually doing a bit of an embroidery type business, a screen printing business, and they were making WWE logo and branded swag, but actually giving it to the boys, including the McMahons themselves.
That is true.
So the allegation is they weren't just doing it to hook up the cast and crew. They were doing it to profiteer as well. And that's what Vince had a problem with.
Well, and apparently, and again, this is all
rumor and innuendo.
Rumor and innuendo was that whoever had the shop in St. Louis or Kansas City, wherever the hell they were, was selling stuff out of his shop.
And that they had made unlicensed without letting the WWE participate.
Right. Right. And that's where the rub came. And because Dave and Earl were associated with them, that was the last straw and they were gone. They came in and left and were escorted out by security.
Did you think that was a fair way to handle them given their time with the company?
I don't know all the particulars, but it was shocking to everybody. That was definitely something that had everybody buzzing. What the hell happened there? But it's also the culture. It's the culture of the company that things happen and you go on with your life and business continues. You still have your job to do and you just move forward, put your head down and go.
I mean, that's kind of what happened with you, right?
Right.
Do you think that if there is a flaw, because you don't often kind of fault Vince with much here, do you think that is a character flaw of his that he can just so quickly move on and throw so many years, you know, because this is the Hebners have been here forever. And now because of maybe a misunderstanding, I mean, I don't know. I wasn't there. Maybe a misunderstanding. Their lives are forever changed. Do you think that's maybe a character flaw of Vince's?
I think it's a flaw, but it's also a defense mechanism for him too, because that way he doesn't have to, you know, deal with it and he can just move on and, you're dead to me. So he just goes on and next. So I guess it's a blessing and a curse all at the same time. When you're there, you know nothing else. It's just, man, it's just the culture. It's just the way that it is.
Right.
And you accept it. And you accept it blindly and you move forward. So, you know, everybody talks about Paul Heyman and the Kool-Aid. The same can be said for, you know, the WWE. Because once you are in that bubble, that is all that exists. Life on the outside doesn't matter and doesn't exist.
Let's talk about the card again, because I feel like this is maybe the strongest year as far as the card that we've ever had for returns. You've got in 2002, Triple H, Hulk Hogan, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, Eddie Guerrero, Chris Benoit, and Shawn Michaels all coming back in 2002. Definitely, you know, the biggest comeback year in history. And to this point on the roster, 15 of the 18 wrestlers would be world champions, either past, present, or future. And Shawn Michaels is still in one of the more featured matches here after, you know, more than 4 years on the sidelines. And Triple H had come back just that prior January. So he's only been back for about 8 months. What was the expectation going into the match? Because it feels like this blows away every expectation possible.
The expectations were low.
I mean, I think that's fair. You know, you've got two guys who haven't worked each other in a long time, no matter how good of friends they are. And yeah, Shawn was one of the greatest of all time, but after a 4.5 year hiatus, you don't expect him to come back and somehow be fucking better than before.
Well, also they had never worked together against each other.
Not like this for sure.
Yeah. And so you've got a lot of just unknowns. We weren't, you know, this sounds funny, but we weren't sure what the hell Shawn's body looked like. We weren't sure if the when the damn shirt came off and the gear came off, you know, what he's going to look like. So we definitely didn't know after he got in the ring and being in front of that crowd. You can go out and do all the cardio you want, do the stepper for hours at a time. That is different than being in the ring and working a match. Completely different cardio, completely different just blowing up factor. So we didn't know if Shawn was going to go out there and blow up in 10 minutes.
Sure.
We didn't know if he was going to get out there and his back was going to seize up. If he was just going to be off half a step, had no clue at all.
The angle leading up to this, who was in charge of the majority writing for that? And who was the agent for the match? Do you remember?
I want to say it was probably Michael Hayes for the match at this time. Brian would have written the majority of the storyline.
Shawn has went on record as saying he didn't feel like he got closure from how his career had ended after WrestleMania 14, where he lost to Steve Austin. And so he goes to Triple H and says he wants to wrestle one more match. And he specifically says he wants to do this because he wants his son to see him wrestle. And he asks Triple H to have the match with him. Is that the way you remember that going down, that it was important to Shawn for his son to see him wrestle, much like we heard Goldberg say earlier this year?
Yes, definitely was. His son had heard about him and had seen, you know, tapes and different things, but he had never seen his dad wrestle.
Do you think, and I'm sure we'll cover this long form at some point, but do you think Shawn's back was as injured as we were told it was at the Royal Rumble in 98, or was Shawn just burnt out and had so much other stuff going on that he just needed to get out of the race car for a little while?
Well, I do believe that his back was injured badly, but sure. I also think that everything else combined exacerbated that.
Right.
Exacerbated the attitude, it exacerbated the injury, and it was the right time to go away.
So it makes all the sense in the world that Shawn wants to come back here, but it also makes sense, as Triple H has said, that going into this match, Shawn was scared, Shawn's wife was scared, and even Shawn's mom was scared. And Triple H says that he told Shawn's mom something like, "I won't let anything happen to your boy." That feels like a big emotional dump that you're going to have in this match. And you guys all kind of felt that you had low expectations. Do you remember that being the thought amongst the writing team, amongst Vince, amongst the boys, or was it just more of a curiosity and just the natural assumption, man, 4.5 years off, I mean, it's not going to be the Shawn of 96.
no one expected the Sean of 96.
Right.
And I, as I had said to Sean when I was in San Antonio, people aren't expecting that. They're just going to be happy to see him come back, throw some punches, and by God, hit the super kick and sell. That's all he had to do. And as I expressed earlier, you know, Sean wanted to be Shawn Michaels of old. He had to be the showstopper in the main event. Nobody, and I mean nobody, expected what we got.
Probably one of the best comeback matches of all. Let's hit some of the high points here. The sidewalk slam onto the folding chair, the backbreaker onto the folding chair. Holy shit, what a spot that was, knowing the history of his back and the story that had been told. And how great was Triple H being bloodied? And then Sean nipping up to a big pop. The crowd was so with it. They were on that emotional roller coaster. That's when you knew to me, this is a great match. And they're pulling out all the stops here. The elbow through the table to the floor seems a little uncharacteristic for a comeback match. But certainly, you know, they're wanting to pull out all the stops. They do the elbow off the ladder, where beforehand Sean points to the crowd and says, I love each and every one of you. And then Sean selling from that elbow and then tuning up the band was just awesome. So one of the better closing sequences, and maybe the best comeback match ever. And Sean is teasing the super kick, but all of a sudden Triple H catches the kick rather than just taking the super kick and giving the fans their happy ending. They do a pedigree counter. And all of a sudden Sean steals a pin and Sean's victorious, but Triple H attacks him after the match with a sledgehammer. What'd you think of the match? This is maybe one of the best matches of 2002. If you haven't seen it, you should go out of your way to see it. Meltzer gave it 4 3/4 stars, saying that, you know, this is a match that lines him up for the WWE Hall of Fame, or the Observer Hall of Fame. What'd you think?
Ooh, I thought that the match top to bottom, emotionally, physically, everything about it delivered on all levels. These guys went out, they're friends, and you're always going to work best with somebody that you like. They proved it. They tore the frigging house down, and it was the right finish. It was the happy finish, but again, it was a one-off. We knew we had Hunter. We knew that what we were doing with Hunter going forward, so we had to get some heat back and make him whole at the end. It wasn't about a 50-50 thing. It was, okay, let's make him happy, but now, you know, I got to worry about the guy that's going to be here tomorrow. And we thought, okay, hey, great. We saw, you know, Sean's last match. He went out in style. I don't think, well, no, I'm not going to say that because I know better. For me, I did not think that was Sean's last match. I look at everybody. I do think we have seen Sean's last match, but I'm skeptical. I always look at all these guys from Undertaker to Angle to everybody. It's like, they got another one left in them.
What was the thinking here? Obviously they do the stretcher job. The doctors come out. What was the thinking here in the sledgehammer finish? It feels like you could have just sent them home happy and let Sean get the pin with a super kick. And then if you wanted to attack him with a sledgehammer, you could. But if you think this is his only match, why not just do it clean with the finish? Was the idea, hey, he's been gone 4 years, Sean's going to have to steal a pin because at this point Triple H just passed him?
No, it's twofold. Honestly, twofold. Because you got Hunter. Hunter's going to be there tomorrow. And what you're being told going in is Sean's not. Sean's right. Gone.
Sure.
So you get your happy win. You won. But now I got to worry about the guy that's going to be here tomorrow night on TV. On the other side of that, you get some heat. Now I got a match. I got a return.
So that's my question. When did you know this is not just a one-off? That may have been what we were signing up for, but Sean's having fun at TV, so this isn't going to be it. We're going to do a series here.
That's a whole nother show. In the back of our mind, we were hoping that was going to be the case. In the back of our mind, we always hoped that Sean was coming back. In Sean's mind, in Vince's mind, in the presentation, that was it.
The finish seems like a compromise to me.
No. It's not a compromise.
There's no negotiation here. The Triple H isn't politicking to get a win. Sean's not trying to negotiate. Hey, I'll take a win, but I'll do the screwy kind of deal.
One off. Sean comes back. He's victorious. And he puts Hunter over with the heat at the end. Sends him away.
Who was the goofball doctor who comes out? Do you know? Do you recognize him?
Yeah, as our actual doctor.
I love that.
What a goofball. He's a nice guy.
I want to ask you briefly about a line that Lawler had on the commentary. I didn't remember this at the time, but somewhere in here, they're fighting outside, and Sean takes a bump off of Hugo's boot, and he hits Triple H in the head with the heel of the boot, and Lawler said a heel for a heel. And it's not often during these times that you would hear the terms face or heel on TV. Do you remember there being any sort of comment from anybody about saying a heel for a heel?
No. I think people understand what a heel is, and it's an inside term, but it's also an everyday term. Yeah, that guy's a heel.
You know, when
he's a bad guy. He's a heel, motherfucker.
When Sean comes back through the curtain after the match, you know, knowing his relationship with Vince, what was that moment like?
Oh, it was very emotional. It was emotional that Sean delivered what he delivered in that match, and it was great to have him back in the ring being Shawn Michaels. And I think that he delivered on what he wanted to go out and be Shawn Michaels and be the showstopper. So very emotional on everybody's part. Just God, I love him. You know, Shawn's like a son to Hunter. I mean, to Vince.
Right. Well, it's one of the better matches of his entire career. I can't recommend it enough. He made everything look effortless. Of course, as we know, this one match would turn into like 8 more years, and Sean didn't officially retire until 2010. In fact, he would win the world title from Triple H just a couple of months later, a few months later, I guess, at the Elimination Chamber at the Survivor Series, which we may or may not be covering for the 15-year anniversary this November. Let's talk a little bit about the next skit, which I guess you had to have some sort of buffer before the main event. You don't want to have something follow this, but you've got Howard Finkel out here, and Howard is putting himself over talking about, you know, I've got a few things I want to get off my chest. And there's a collective groan from the crowd. He says this is his first pay-per-view in that arena since WrestleMania 2. And that was something called commitment, which is something that the Major League Baseball guys can't say, because they might be going on strike, but the fans can always count on the Fink. Here comes Trish Stratus, and Fink says 2 weeks ago she slapped him on Raw, and then last week she pushed him into the pool, but not to get too cocky, because she's just in an arena full of Long Island skanks. And of course, she says she has a surprise for him, takes her jacket off, and Fink says this is a dog-eat-dog world, and she has the puppies, but he has the wiener.
But I have the wiener.
That's what I needed. Can you do the whole line? I feel like people need this as like a ringtone.
Well, Trish, while this may be a dog eat dog world, you have the puppies and I have the wiener.
Thank you.
Look, man.
The wiener.
People can shit on it all they want and talk about, oh, this was all trash. Go back and listen to the pop Trish gets when she comes out for this little gaga light moment.
Well, then Lillian Garcia.
Great shit.
I love you defending this. Then Lillian comes in from behind as Trish's surprise and kicks Fink Fink in the dink dink. Who booked this shit, and why can I imagine Vince laughing about all this?
Ah, she dinked him in the dink dink. You gotta love it. Take that, Finkel. Yeah, you goddamn fucking.
Yeah, Vince did love it. Again, you gotta give credit where credit's due. Send your hate mail to Brian Gewirtz. Heel Finkel, come on. Heel Howard was a great character. Cool. Allow me to introduce to you why the long face, Lillian.
Oh my, let's move on.
Oh, it was great shit, man. Howard is a heel and feuding with Lillian because they both had this sense of self-importance that
you have the puppies and I have the wiener. God, I love it. Look at him. Look at him. Kick him in the wee-wee. Kick him in the wee-wee, Lillian.
Kick him in the wee-wee. Kick him in the wee-wee. Come into the t-shirt store soon. Can we move on?
Yeah.
A little bit of history about the world title match. During the in-ring promo on Raw, we have Vince announce that Austin's gone and that the winner of the King of the Ring tournament is going to get a shot at the undisputed title at SummerSlam. Well, Brock wins the tournament, beating RVD in the finals. So that gets us here. Rock Lesnar for the undisputed title. And man, the buildup for this was super fun. You know, they're showing that Brock is now a monster. There's a training video for both guys, which is super old school. It feels very Hogan-esque. I loved it. Something cool about seeing the Rock workout in Miami at the football stadium too. And they're positioning Brock as a monster. They're showing him smear Hulk Hogan's blood over his chest. And what do you know? This is when we finally see the next big thing become the big thing. Lesnar gets the win here over The Rock. I enjoyed this match. It got 3 3/4 stars. I thought it was a pretty good match, and it had a lot of heat from the crowd. There are some fun Rocky sucks chants. I guess at this point, some fans are ready for a change. They're tired of The Rock, and they're just really into the Brock character. But I thought for what it was, this is a pretty good match. What'd you think?
I thought it was a great match. It was a great story. Building up Brock, it was just beautifully done. And to see that big bastard go in there and deliver on the level that he did. And for Rock, you know, Rock was going away. People knew that he was leaving. So they were ready. You know, they were ready for him to go. They were pissed off that he was leaving because, you know, anytime that somebody leaves, it's like, why are you leaving us? This is bullshit. But it was the anointing of a new champion, and I thought it was done the right way, and it was just perfection, and it was a perfect way to cap off the night.
I think it's a match that I would recommend everybody check out. I know I've said that for a few segments here, but that Nydia thing is awesome. The damn Shawn Michaels match is incredible, and this is hard to beat here with Rock and Brock in the main event. Because the crowd is so far into Lesnar, it's not even funny. And remember, Rock's one of the most over characters ever, but it is New York. They know he's leaving, so they're chanting at the top of their lungs, let's go Lesnar and Rocky sucks. Eventually, Rock even looks to the crowd, flips them off, and says, fuck you. It's just super fun stuff here. And Brock is being relentless. He's throwing Rock around like you see him do in 2017. And eventually, I saw something that I kind of forgot when I was watching this back. Paul Heyman took a bump through an announcer's table. I don't remember seeing that before. It feels like something that would have had to be negotiated. But, you know, right after, because maybe the move didn't go extremely well, you see The Rock getting his ear trying to check on him. What did you think of Paul's job taking a bump here through the announcer's table?
I thought it was great. No, and no, there was nothing wrong with that bump. That's always customary. And if you know what you're looking for, some guys are more obvious than others, but you always want to check on somebody in some kind of crazy bump like that. And Paul wasn't a worker. Paul wasn't somebody that took bumps every night. So you just want to make sure that he's okay and everything's all good in Heyman Town.
According to the rumor and innuendo, when Paul takes the bump, Taz is seen cheering loudly. Which I thought was hilarious. I thought it was a cool deal here where they do the Rock Bottom and it looks like that's going to be the pin and Brock kicks out. Eventually Brock hits his own Rock Bottom and Rock kicks out. Rock goes for the people's elbow, but Brock hops right up and levels him with the clothesline. They go into a great series of spots here where Lesnar finally hits the F5 for the clean pinfall. And the crowd just goes nuts. I don't think that The Rock could have done a better job putting the guy over. And it capped off one of the best pay-per-views ever. There's a fun spot in here that I'd kind of forgot until I saw it again this time, where Rock and Brock do simultaneous kip-ups. and the crowd is just hot for everything. I think this might be one of The Rock's best matches ever. What say you, Bruce?
Yeah, that went banana. The pop is a beautiful. It was great on every level. It was the way to make a champion, and it was way to take a guy like Brock Lesnar that people were still on the fence about Brock. And it was a way to take him to the next level and having the big star put him over the right way and make him the champion and take him to that next stratosphere. I thought it was absolutely positively beautiful. Enjoyed the shit out of it. And you keep saying about how, you know, go back and watch this match. What you have been saying this whole show, go back and watch this show. Top to bottom, it delivered. And we talked about the Shawn Michaels Triple H match right before this, which was great and could have ended the show. But like I said, we didn't know what we had. So we ended it here, and this didn't disappoint as well. Put in the last spot, it delivered in the last spot and was a fucking excellent match.
Now, right after the match, according to the rumor and innuendo, Rock jumped right on a plane and went to the hospital to go see the birth of his first child. Is that how that went down as far as you remember?
Yes, I believe so. Yes.
Isn't it a little ironic that Kurt Angle gets his first world title win beating The Rock, and so does Brock Lesnar?
Well, there you go. If you're gonna do the job to somebody, wouldn't you like to do it to Kurt Angle and Brock Lesnar?
Well,
these two guys that you really couldn't
beat? Sure, absolutely.
Wanted to.
There's been some discussion that once upon a time someone pitched there being kind of a scary finish here, but Rock vetoed that and wanted to lose clean in the middle. Do you remember that?
100%. I don't know anybody ever pitching a screwy finish. But I do know that Rock was adamant about putting Brock over in the middle with his finish. He's like, if I'm going to lose it, I'm losing it in the middle with this finish.
This is just a few months after the Rock Hogan WrestleMania, where Rock was supposed to be the face, but everybody was cheering Hogan like crazy. And here, you know, Lesnar's supposed to be the heel, but New York is cheering him like crazy. Was that expected going in? You knew, hey, it's a smart crowd. They know he's leaving. They're going to boo him.
Well, we knew because of the reactions that we had been getting leading up to it.
Right.
People knew The Rock was going away to do a movie, and the writing was on the wall. The smart fans knew it, and they didn't like it. And they saw Brock coming up. They're like, okay, hey, man, give me the big man and let him squash him. So, yeah, we knew it. We expected it. Rock knew going in. And that's kind of, you know, as you see the match go on, he flipped everybody off. He turns heel in the middle of it just to give them that. Okay, you want him? You got him.
Was Brock winning the belt something Heyman had lobbied for? Heyman's the head writer of SmackDown. Obviously, Brock is real-life friends with Heyman. So now he's got the title on his boy, and he's writing for the show. Was that something he was campaigning for, or did Vince just see it because of the size and the natural athleticism in Brock?
We all campaigned for it. It was a natural progression. Yes, Heyman was definitely in on it, but we all were in on it. And Rock was in on it big time. Rock felt very strongly about Brock being the guy and felt that he could be the guy to take it to the next level.
Lesnar became the youngest world champion in history here, winning it at just 25 years old. Of course, a couple years after this, Randy Orton would break that record, being the youngest man to win it. All in all, though, this kind of explained the Stephanie laugh from earlier in the show, because now Lesnar is taking the world title to SmackDown. It's no longer on Raw, and Bischoff the next day would award the big gold belt, the old WCW title. He would just hand it to Triple H on Raw. And so now we've got, two separate belts again.
Hated it.
Yeah.
Hated it. Made no sense.
Well, it happened, and we'll break it down on another time. But first, let's put a bow on SummerSlam. A great pay-per-view that everybody – was this high fives all around? Everybody knew this was a home run?
Do.
Hell yeah. Is this the greatest SummerSlam of all time, in your opinion?
In my opinion, after watching it again, yeah, I would go home and watch it again, and probably will.
anything else you want to mention about SummerSlam 02 before we get to this week's poll?
I think I'm good.
Well, we're going to be good next week because we have got an old school poll for you. If you're a big fan of the 1980s, I have got a surprise for you. You can vote in our poll and it's going to be all about the 80s, baby. Cruise on over to facebook.com/somethingtowrestle. That's where you'll find the poll this week. Like us on Facebook and be sure to check us out during Raw and SmackDown. You never know when we might jump in and do a little Facebook live action. And we might even get a chance to do it on Thursday since Bruce's ass is fired from yet another wrestling company. Poll topic number one, what, Bruce.
You know what, though? I am the number one sports podcast in the world. Want to see my trophy?
What am I?
You're the co-host. I got the trophy. Want to see a trophy?
You know that I introduce the show and post it and edit it and do the research and record.
I know. I love you.
I love you too.
Folks, we wouldn't have a show if it wasn't for Conrad. I even said that last night at the award ceremony. You see the trophy?
I see the trophy.
Okay.
You know what? You're going to see a great poll topic. Poll topic number one, the Honky Tonk Man. What might we talk about if Honky Tonk Man wins the poll?
He's just a honky tonk man. I'm a honky tonk man. He's a honky tonk man. He's a honky tonk man. Oh, geez, so much to talk about the Honky Tonk Man, from his controversial being the greatest intercontinental champion of all time to the time that he tore his pec and Vince's reaction to the Honky Tonk Man tearing his pec, which was probably one of my all-time favorite Vince reactions to something. But I think Honky Tonk's history speaks for itself, and we will address it, by God.
Poll topic number two, the Big Boss Man. What might we talk about if the Big Boss Man wins the poll?
Well, first of all, how the hell he became the Big Boss Man and the conversation leading up to it, including the making of all those Big Boss Man vignettes, going into the prison for the very first time and actually shooting Boss Man vignettes inside of an active prison, which was kind of crazy, and the transition from him from heel to babyface, and all kinds of fun Raid trailer stories along the way.
Third up, here we go. The Macho Man, Randy Savage, he's poll topic number three. What might we talk about if Mach wins the poll?
Freak out, freak out. Oh, yeah, we're going to talk about this a bit. We're going to talk about the relationship with the Macho Man, traveling up and down the roads with Randy and Liz, staying at his house, one of the few people that he ever opened his house up to actually stay there. But so many Randy Savage stories that if this one wins, we're going to have to do a two-parter at least for Randy Savage, if Randy Savage wins, because there's just so much to cover.
Last but certainly not least, he's been on a few times. I hope he wins this time. That's just me being a homer. Jake the Snake Roberts, one of the most underrated performers of all time, is poll topic number four.
We're going to talk about the creation of the DDT. We're not only going to talk about Jake's career, and we can go all the way back to Mid-South when Jake the Snake Roberts was working for Bill Watts when I first got to know Jake. But when Jake made his move over to the WWF, Jake also being somewhat instrumental in me coming over and the evolution of Jake. And we'll talk about some dark times and, of course, get to the happy ending that is Jake the Snake Roberts today.
So there you go. There's your poll this week. Check it out. Go ahead and vote right now. It's facebook.com/somethingtowrestle. Honky Tonk Man, Big Boss Man, The Macho Man, and Jake the Snake Roberts. I should have put another poll topic in with man in there. I got three men. Anyway, which one is your favorite man? Go vote right now. facebook.com/somethingtowrestle. And we'll see you next week right here, probably talking about The Macho Man, on Something to Wrestle With,
the award-winning podcast of Bruce Pritchard.
I was going to say it's like the number one sports and recreation podcast in the world. And that's not just a rumor and innuendo. It's award-winning.
Now, I got a trophy to prove it.
You know what's funny, too? We won the fucking sports and recreation category. It's not even real sports. Like, we're up against UFC, NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball.
NBA.
It's a fucking rib.
Bill Simmons.
Yeah.
Dan Le Batard.
Smashed.
They're like real sportscaster guys.
How many other wrestling podcasts were nominated?
That would be zero.
The same number that won. Roll title, Nat. Bruce Pritchard.
John brings his skewed sense of humor. Jeff brings tips to cut strokes off your next round. Together, it's those weekend golf guys.
They'll pay a lot of money to PXG and Titleist and Callaway and on and on and on. Right? How many yards do you think you're going to pick up with that extra driver? I think I can get an extra 5 to 10. What if I give you 15 to 20? You pay me more.
Jeff Smith right? teaches on the sliding scale.
Those weekend golf guys, the podcast, part of the Believe Network. Just search BLEAV on YouTube or wherever you listen.